We're going to get started. I'm going to call to order the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. Today is March 24th. Just for those of you that are in the audience, I just want to make it very clear that signs are not permitted in the committee room. So if you have them, place them on the floor. I don't want to see them. So signs are not permitted in the committee room. Members, we do have a quorum, and so the chair moves that House File 292 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Rukavina, welcome to the committee. Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tom Rukavina. I didn't know, I've never had to state my name for this record at another committee before. So, Madam Chair and members, I think we know what this bill is all about, and I don't know how you want me to proceed. I do have some proponents today. Joni Whiting, who's the mother of a cancer victim, and Norm Samper, who is the former police chief of Seattle. I did have one other witness, but evidently he ran into some police officers that I knew, and so we can't find him anymore. He's left, but...
Excuse me, Representative Rukavina, I just want to make it clear to members, I have allocated an hour for this hearing. So I'm going to ask those that are in favor to try to limit your comments to 20 minutes,
so,
and those that
so
are
Madam
opposed
Chair,
to limit it to 20 minutes that we have time to have make sure that members have opportunity to have their questions.
I just have two witnesses then, and I do have Heather Ozzie here from the attorney for the Minnesota Compassionate Care, and I'm kind of feeling under the weather today. I've been sick for 3 days, so... I don't know how you want me to proceed, if you want just a quick overview of the bill.
Representative Rukavina, we only want to talk about the areas of the bill that would be covered in public safety. So why don't you have your testifiers come to the table and let them talk about it, and if members have questions about specific pieces, Representative
Rukavina. Well, I'll do that. Well, then, Madam Chair, first I'll call Joni Whiting, I think, to the table, and she can tell you her story. You know, the reason I think this bill is needed is it's about compassionate, inexpensive treatment for terminally and seriously ill patients. And I think it's a decision between a physician and his or her patient, and people who are sick and dying at the end of their lives, who battle with a debilitating disease, or who have gotten no relief for, you know, common ways of treating pain, deserve to be listened to on this issue. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to bring Joni up here and let her tell you her story.
Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Joni Whiting, and I appreciate the opportunity to tell my story. However, I want to be clear from the outset, there's nothing being done here in this room today that will benefit my family or me. There is nothing you can give to ease our pain. I will suffer the rest of my life for what I have lost. I'm here today only to tell you about a woman I loved and lost 6 years ago. I ask only that you listen to her story, to walk just briefly in her shoes, and mine. My daughter, Stephanie, was a wife, a loving mother of three, and a beloved employee of Dart Distributing. Stephanie had a unique and beautiful voice, the voice of an angel. In June of 2000, at 24 years of age, Stephanie was diagnosed with melanoma skin cancer on her face. A mole had gone bad during her pregnancy, and it was already too late. The next 2 years were filled with experimental therapies and endless surgeries as they cut her face off 1 inch at a time until there was nothing left to cut. There was nothing to put back over the hole in her face. All but four of her teeth had been removed due to the side effects of the chemotherapy. The skin grafts had failed. It was difficult for her to eat. The nausea was so severe that the medications gave her little to no relief. A doctor at the hospital pulled me aside one day and told me she may get some benefit and some relief from smoking marijuana. But that wasn't an acceptable option for me or her, being drug-free. In addition, the legal ramifications associated with illegal use were frightening. After her 10th surgery, all efforts to save her life had failed, and her oncologist predicted that she had about 6 months to live. At that time, she was taking approximately 40 to 50 tablets of OxyContin and about 30 to 40 tablets of Roxycodone per day. Yet her pain was still evident in every breath she took and in every movement. Her whole body was racked with continuous and unrelenting pain. There was nothing to stop it. Nothing to slow it down, and the hope for a miracle faded as my child bravely began to make plans for the ending of her life. When Zofran, the anti-nausea drug, continued to give her no relief, Stephanie began to lose weight. We asked her doctor to prescribe Marinol, a synthetic version of THC, one of the active chemical compounds in marijuana. But even taking this in pill form didn't abate any of her symptoms, and she stopped taking it because it didn't work. As her tumors grew larger, it became more and more difficult for her to eat, though the tumors growing inside and outside of her mouth, her throat, and her chest. My other children then begged me to let her use marijuana, and when I refused, they took her out of my home. When she came back 3 days later, she told me that she'd gotten hungry after using it and that the marijuana had kicked up her appetite, as well as allowed her to keep the food down. She had eaten 3 meals a day at a time when she'd routinely eat nothing for days at a time. She had just a touch of energy back, and she looked better than I had seen her in months. For reasons I don't know, marijuana also enhanced the effects of her pain medication and didn't make her appear high. My only regret is not allowing her to use marijuana in my home throughout her illness. Yet the fear of being caught was significant. I then called a number of my family members and friends of our family and asked if they knew of anywhere we could purchase marijuana. The next morning, someone had placed a package of it on our doorstep. I have never known who to thank for it, but I remain grateful beyond belief. I was prepared to defend my daughter's use to anyone who asked. In retrospect, I can tell you with conviction that I would have no problem going to jail for acquiring medical marijuana for my suffering child. Allah is unjust. And I would rather spend the rest of my life in prison than have denied her the medicine that kept her pain at bay and allowed her to live 89 more days. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, quote, "I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the consciousness of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law," unquote. I am here today to tell you that I am no longer willing to support making criminals out of the sick and dying. I saw with my own eyes that it worked. I have dedicated a large portion of my own life to helping people stay clean and drug-free, and I see no contradiction in this at all. My daughter was able to eat for nearly 3 more months because of marijuana. I allowed her to use it in my home before meals because it worked and helped her, and every day of her life was precious to her and her small children. We had Thanksgiving and Christmas that year with her at the table that year. Having her there was priceless. Shortly after Stephanie was placed on 24-hour nursing care and could no longer use the marijuana, her pain was so severe that when she asked my husband and I to lie down on both sides of her and hold her, she couldn't stand the pain of us touching her body. She was on IV morphine, and she moaned in pain continuously. Her hospice nurses were so disturbed by the severity of her pain, they finally used IV lidocaine to numb her whole body. The morphine, even at the strongest dose allowed by law, gave her no relief. On January 14th at 1:30 in the morning, with her beloved children sleeping in their beds in the other rooms, Stephanie died in the room she grew up in, holding my hand. Her strong heart continued to beat for nearly 3 minutes after she stopped breathing. She was 26 years old. They say there's no greater loss than that of a child for a parent and their rights. For this government to deny those who need medical marijuana to lessen the severity of their pain, their nausea, and seizures, is unjustifiable. To threaten the sick and dying and their loved ones with jail unconscionable. I am a Vietnam veteran, and my youngest son recently returned from 15 months in Iraq. We are a family that honors this country, having served it in the military in every conflict since the Revolutionary War. I don't use drugs. I don't abuse alcohol. I've raised four children, and I'm currently raising the children my daughter had to leave behind. What would you have done had you been in my shoes? Could you sleep at night with your child screaming in pain? What price would you willing to pay to relieve the suffering of someone that you love? I was the one that listened to her screams. I was the one that saw everything that she suffered. No human being should ever have to suffer again what my child suffered. My daughter and I were forced to break a law to ease the pain of a cruel and punishing illness. The fact is, you can't do anything for me. My daughter is dead. But there are others in similar situations right now in Minnesota. They deserve compassion, dignity, and mercy. You can provide some amount of relief to them by passing this bill. I am not asking you. I am begging you for that relief. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina.
I have pictures.
Madam Chair.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, there are some pictures that Ms. Whiting would like to be to see. And then, Madam Chair, as I mentioned, I have Norm Stamper, who is the former chief of police in Seattle, Washington, who would like to testify and answer.
Please have him come to the table. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Norm Stamper. I was the police chief in Seattle at the time that the citizens of the state of Washington voted through initiative for medical marijuana. That was in 1998. I've spent pretty much my entire adult life as a police officer. I started in the city of San Diego, spent 28 years there, was the number two guy when I was recruited to become the police chief in Seattle in 1994. For reasons that are both professional and personal, I supported the initiative that led to that law in the state of Washington. The personal reasons are reflective of the story we've just heard. There were two people in my personal life who were affected by intractable, debilitating pain, one of whom was suffering from a terminal illness. It was also my belief professionally that the police, as important as our voice is in the conversation, in the dialogue about drug policy, are not physicians, are not caregivers, and that it is inappropriate for the police to substitute our judgment for that of physicians and those in need of the care of physicians. I supported the initiative quietly. I didn't vocally campaign for it. I shared with a number of other police officials in the state of Washington my personal and professional view. There was opposition, resistance to this bill in the state of Washington, as there has been in the other 12 states that currently have medical marijuana laws. I understand that resistance. I understand that opposition. I understand, especially after 40 years of prosecuting this nation's drug war and drug policy, why police officers would oppose any changes, and particularly those that might legalize, even by narrow definition, any currently illicit drugs. But I do believe that the people have spoken in the state of Washington, and when it came time to implement that initiative, I simply stated to my police officers that we now know the will of the people, that medical marijuana is a reality, a law in the state of Washington, and we will in fact abide by that law, letter and spirit. One of the difficulties that I had in implementing the policy is frankly because it was a citizen's initiative It lacked structure. It lacked particularity and detail. Let me cite some glaring examples. The law provided for a 60-day supply of medical marijuana with no definition of what that meant. We had no idea what the voters had in mind. There was nothing codified. A 60-day supply was left, if you will, to the interpretation of law enforcement and prosecutors. There was no registry. In other words, you did not have to sign up for this program. There was no commission. There was no dispensary system. There was essentially nothing in place. A physician could recommend medical marijuana without prescription, of course, because that would have run afoul in the minds of many of our physicians of the federal law. But they could also orally recommend marijuana. There would be no record of it. The system, in short, was very, very loose. That led, I'm sure, in part to today's reality. Today, in the state of Washington, we have 35,510 medical marijuana patients. My own belief is that at 5.5 persons per 1,000 population, that is not an unrealistic figure. It is, however, roughly 5 times the number of patients that you might anticipate, given the restrictions that you have engineered into this bill, into this prospective law. 2.5 ounces of marijuana, total of 6 plants, as I understand it, possibly down from 12. In Washington, as recently as the latter stages of 2008, the health department stepped in, held a long series of meetings with the public, with medical professionals, with caregivers or providers, as they are known in that state, and recipients of medical marijuana. These are people suffering debilitating pain, and terminal illness. A number of conditions were identified. Those conditions will vary from one state to the next. They listened to voters. They listened to, once again, the medical community and the law enforcement community. By this time, the law enforcement community that had 10 years previously opposed the legislation was on board, and there was strong support coming from the law enforcement community to work together with the medical community to set a level which would represent the amount of marijuana that a medical patient could in fact possess, or a provider could provide. That level, incidentally, is 24 ounces and 15 plants. Originally, there was talk of mature versus immature plants. They ultimately decided, the Public Health Department of the State of Washington, that it would in fact be 15 plants and 24 ounces. You are looking, as I mentioned, at 2.5 ounces. So we have a lot more medical marijuana patients in our state in proportion to population than you can anticipate here. Your model, the one you are considering, is very close to the Colorado model. That is a state that has 0.09 marijuana patients per 1,000. You will probably have 0.13 marijuana patients per 1,000, given what we can anticipate from medical marijuana experience now in the 13 states. But I think the real question is, what has happened to our state as a result of this law? Well, I'm pleased to report that crime overall, and in particular, all of the index crimes, the serious crimes, are down dramatically in the state of Washington. For the first time in 4 or 5 years, every single crime category experienced during 2008 a major reduction. The city of Seattle is experiencing its lowest crime rate in 40 years. Even more impressive, we have seen a very significant reduction in marijuana use in a state that has one of the leastest definitions of medical marijuana among those 13 states. let me be particular about this. Every single grade level through high school has experienced, both in current use and lifetime use, double-digit reductions in marijuana use. It sounds so terribly, bless you, counterintuitive. How is it that a state that has adopted medical marijuana, which in theory, it is suggested by some from my former law enforcement community, would increase availability? It has not done that. And in fact, eighth graders are reporting now lifetime use levels that are 62% reduced over what they were when this legislation was passed. We can speculate, and frankly, we would be forced to, because nobody really knows for sure why we've seen that reduction in that state. It's also a reduction echoed by all of the other 12 states throughout the country that have adopted medical marijuana laws. The theory is that we have now made medicine out of what was formerly an illicit drug. It's suggested by some that young people are all about questioning authority and doing things they're told not to do. That's certainly not every young person, but it's a fair percentage of young people. And one of the theories that my colleagues and I share with one another is that, in fact, having made this product, a medicine, in the context of medical marijuana, it has removed the mystique. Whether that's a legitimate theory or not, whether it's the explanation or not, it's certainly worth considering. So these huge reductions in crime, huge reductions in marijuana possession and consumption has really produced an incredible level of support for the medical marijuana law. Opposition by my law enforcement colleagues, the vast majority of them, has either been eliminated or neutralized. And they now participate fully at the table in deciding such things as possession levels. I'm pleased to report that if you were asking me how is it going in the state of Washington, my one-word response would be well. My two-word response would be very well, from the point of view of all of the stakeholders involved in that state. Thank you.
Thank you. Final comments, Representative Rukavina. You've got 1 minute left.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say that in the 13 states that currently have it, 9 of them were empowered by a constitutional amendment, of which there were really overwhelming support. And, there are a lot of supporters for this bill, including the American College of Physicians, the American and Minnesota Nurses Association, and various other groups that are involved in the practice of medicine. And, members, to me, again, that's what it's all about here today, is a decision between a doctor and his patient as to what's best for the health of that patient. And so, Madam Chair, I guess we'll wrap it up until we get towards the end. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Those of you that are opposed, I do have some on the list. It's my understanding that the commissioner would like to speak as well. So if you'd like to be first, we'd be happy to let you go first. But those of you, we're going to stick to 20 minutes, just as we did with those in favor. So you might want to come down with multiple chairs so that you don't waste the time while we're waiting for folks to come down the aisle. We're going to save all the questions so after all of the testimony, that way I can, let both sides get their points across. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael Canfield is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. With no disrespect to the authors of the bill and the families and loved ones who suffered and gone through the pain and agony, we're here to testify against this legislation. We think it's misguided. And this administration has been opposed to it for a number of years. Two reasons why. One, from a health standpoint, there's a lot of anecdotal stories, but there's very little hard evidence to indicate that this bill will accomplish what it intends to accomplish. But from a public safety standpoint, and secondarily, this piece of legislation puts Minnesota's law enforcement and prosecution community, and judges, I might add, I think in conflict with federal law. It's still against the law to possess marijuana, and we would be in conflict with our federal partners. There's a number of problems with the bill. Others will go through it. But I will try to come up. I will try to comment on a couple of practical and common sense concerns that are different, I think, hopefully, than other people's, other people who are going to testify. There's a lot of discussion about people who have serious illnesses at the end of their life, but there's nothing in this bill that focuses the use of marijuana on end-of-life treatment. Quite frankly, with this piece of legislation, I could get a prescription for marijuana for shin splints, and it just does not intend to focus on what the testimony has indicated. Second, I couldn't agree more with the chief from Seattle that this is less a law enforcement issue than it is a health issue. The Federal Food and Drug Administration and other major American Medical Association have not approved marijuana for medical purposes. The FDA has served this country well for 120 years. It has not approved this drug for medical purposes. And lastly, this may be a little bit of a stretch, Madam Chair, but I don't think that it is. I was watching a program the other day about the Mexican wars down on the borders of the United States and Mexico. There's more people lost their lives down there in the last year than in Iraq and Afghanistan put together. The carnage down there is just beyond comprehension, quite frankly. 6,500 people, I think, were killed in the last year. And there's one reason and one reason only for that war and that level of carnage and that devastation, and that is the appetite for illegal drugs in this country. The trade routes that are in competition and people warring over that to try to get illegal drugs into this country is the number one cause of that horrible situation which is spilling over into this country. I think that this piece of legislation will increase the appetite for marijuana in this country, and I don't know that that's a good public policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bushman, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Bushman. I'm the statewide gang and drug task force coordinator for the Department of Public Safety. Madam Chair, as we get started, I have a couple of handouts to offer to go along with my presentation, if that's all right.
That's fine.
First one is a letter from the Law Enforcement Coalition to Governor Plenty, and the second is part of a PowerPoint presentation that illustrates some of the things I'm going to talk about. Okay? Before I get started, there's something else that I'd like to clear up with the committee. And you've likely heard over the last several weeks or in personal visits from your office that us in law enforcement have not been willing to share our concerns with the proponents of this legislation, that we've not been willing to meet with them, and that they've made almost all the changes we recommended, and we will still not support this bill. This is too important of a bill and an issue to let these misstatements stand. The fact of the matter is that our coalition did meet with the author of this bill last year. We articulated almost two dozen concerns that we had with the bill, of which only three were actually addressed. And since that time, the proponents have said they fixed all of our concerns. This is not only just flat out wrong, it's a distortion of the truth. We heard there are numerous specific problems that law enforcement has with this bill. It's not the tightest crafted bill in the country, as some people claim. We testified in every committee about our concerns, and we've handed out a detailed position paper, which you have in front of you today, that outlines our concerns. Despite this information, no changes have been made to this bill to address any of these concerns. Also, for the record, members, our coalition met again with the proponents of this bill before this session started. We reiterated our concerns yet again, and the response was to introduce a bill that was even worse than the one that was here last year. So as you listen to the debate today, I hope that you'll focus on the facts and the specifics of the bill with an eye toward what's best public safety policy for the state. Madam Chair, I brought along some visuals that I'd like to present to you while I'm talking.
They're not signs, are they?
Not signs.
Okay.
One of the concerns that we've had with this bill ever since it hit the legislature is the amount of marijuana that this bill would allow patients and caregivers to have access to. What I'm going to lay out in front of you is roughly 6.5 pounds of processed marijuana, which is about half of what you could expect to get from 12 marijuana plants, which are currently allowed in the current legislation. Over the past couple of years, and I know this because I've testified, there's been argument about how much marijuana we're actually talking about. So I brought some lists to lay out in front of you to give you an idea of what those amounts are. This bill also allows for a patient to possess 2.5 ounces of marijuana, which is roughly 70 grams. This is 70 grams of marijuana, roughly 2.5 ounces. This is enough marijuana to roll 140 marijuana joints, figuring a half a gram of marijuana to a cigarette. That's a lot of cigarettes. There's enough marijuana stacked in front of us here, off these bags, roughly 6.5 pounds, 105 ounces, 2,959 grams, which would be 5,918 marijuana cigarettes, which would be 16 marijuana cigarettes per day for 1 year. If you were awake 24 hours a day, that would be a joint and a half, a joint every hour and a half. During a 12-hour day, you'd be able to smoke one joint every 45 minutes, which is not only medication, that would be a constant state of intoxication. Why people would be allowed to have access to or possess this much marijuana, any kind of medication this amount, baffles us. This is way over the amount that any person could reasonably smoke or would need. Another problem that we have with the bill is, unlike anything else you buy at the store, whether it be aspirin, chewing gum, or breath mint, there is no regulation in this bill anywhere that regulates the production, that regulates the distribution, that regulates the packaging, that requires cleanliness or health codes by the people that are producing it, any warning labels, or anything of the sort. You can't even buy aspirin without having to go through some of those hoops to ensure that there's a product out there that's safe. There's no way to regulate the dosage. People purchasing and growing marijuana would have no idea what the dosage is of the marijuana that they're being exposed to, where it came from, or what the situations were. I can tell you from personal experience that the conditions in some of these grow houses are deplorable. And you don't have to take my word for it. I would defer to a lot of my colleagues in the back of the room who have spent years and years and years doing narcotics investigations, and they can tell you. If it's referred to the handout that I passed around, the green-colored one, talking about increased plant size and yield, one of the arguments from the proponents of legalization is that these plants typically only produce about 100 grams of marijuana per plant. And as I've told you before, you know, that's not true. If you take a look at the second page, and these are photographs that I got from a police officer in Oregon, a state that has a medical marijuana law, you can see the size of the plant in the grow as opposed to the trailer that's parked in the yard. Take a look at the next page, you can see the size of the marijuana plants inside the greenhouse as opposed to the pickup truck that's parked in the drive. If you go on to the next page, you can see the size of these marijuana trees next to an agent who's about 6'2" tall. We're not talking about small plants with small quantities. We're talking about large plants that have capable of multi-pound yields. Take a look at the following pages talking about the numbers. We don't have to go through all of them, but as of January 1st, 2009, in Oregon, a medical marijuana state, there were 21,541 patients. That's a 7,800 patient increase over the past year. 2,847 attending physicians have recommended marijuana, and 10 physicians have made 75% of all recommendations in the state. Taking that further, you have one physician that's made recommendations to 35% of the people, about 7,500 folks. At that rate, he'd be seeing 29 patients a day during a year's time to give them their permission. Those are some of the problems as law enforcement that we have with the bill that's currently before us today. Following up on what Norm Stamper had to say about the war on drugs being lost, being a failure, no, we haven't been able to eliminate drug use. We haven't been able to eliminate the appetite for drugs. I don't believe that means that we should throw in the towel. We haven't been able to eliminate murder, rape, or robbery yet either, and we're not ready to throw in the towel on those crimes either. That'll be the end of my testimony, and Phil Polkopowicz from the Dakota County Attorney's Office also has a presentation for you. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Philip Polkopowicz. I'm the Chief Deputy Dakota County Attorney. I'm also here on behalf of the Law Enforcement Coalition. What this legislation is about is more than just compassionate care for individuals suffering from serious diseases such as cancer and other terminal illnesses. This legislation is about much more. The former chief from Seattle is correct that we're talking about a legislation that is going to authorize about 6,000 to 7,000 patient cards. That's according to the study that was done, the fiscal study that was done in this particular case. That is very similar to the Colorado perspective. However, the vast majority of those, for example, in Colorado, over 87%, had absolutely nothing to do with cancer and other serious and terminal illnesses. The vast majority of those cards were issued for serious pain unrelated to those specific diseases. And it doesn't even really matter. It really doesn't even matter if you look at the definitions and you look at all the provisions of this bill. Because, for example, in Section 7 of the bill, there is an affirmative defense. An affirmative defense that applies not just to this particular legislation, but to any marijuana prosecution. Any marijuana prosecution, all that is required is for an individual to come forward to get a doctor to say that the benefits of using marijuana for medical purposes would lightly outweigh the health risk for the person, irrespective of whether they're suffering from any type of disease that has been authorized as stated in the particular legislation. That's how broad this particular bill is in this case. As Mr. Bushman has pointed out to you, this is not a very tight bill. There is not one piece of wording in this legislation that authorizes the Commissioner of Health, the Commissioner of Public Safety, or any other state or local individual to establish guidelines and rules and regulations for the cultivation, the distribution, and the possession of this. It does authorize the Commissioner, for example, to go out and do reasonable inspections of some of these facilities. But what they're going to enforce, if there's no authority to establish what the minimal standards are in this particular case, and how are we going to attempt to defend the Commissioner's decision-making process as it goes through? What this particular legislation does is basically authorize the creation of not hundreds, but potentially thousands of marijuana grow operations throughout our cities, throughout our suburbs, throughout our towns, in our rural areas. These are grow operations that are at significant public safety concerns. I do have two photographs that I wish to hand out to the committee members. This is a marijuana operation that we busted or went into about 2 to 3 weeks ago in the city of St. Paul. There were 9 mature marijuana plants in there. You will also see in those photographs the weaponry that those two individuals had. The reason they had that type of weaponry, the bulletproof vest, the AK-47 and the handguns that you'll see in that, is because they were ripped off about 2 months ago and they needed that protection, or felt they needed protection to protect themselves against future drug ripoff. That is what some of the individuals will be facing, not only them, but their neighbors and associates with the particular property in this particular bill. That is a significant concern to us in the law enforcement community. What is even greater concern to us in the law enforcement community is, given the significant public safety concerns, law enforcement is completely written out of this bill. Every piece of data that's collected by the Commissioner of Health in the application process is considered private data and cannot be shared to the law enforcement community in any way, shape, or form. These grow operations will be going throughout our communities, and law enforcement will never know about it. And even if they stumble across it during the course of an investigation and they attempt to identify the legitimacy of this particular grow operation, they contact the Commissioner of Health. The Commissioner of Health can't even tell them and verify that this person was in fact a medical marijuana user. All they can do under this bill is basically tell them, yeah, we did issue a card with that number, but I can't tell you who, what address, or what terms and conditions. That is significant problems to the law enforcement community in this particular case.
I just want to let you know
yep.
that we do have 4 people that have signed up, and
I'm
you have 3-4 minutes left.
I have one more thing I do want to point out, and that's the penalty provision in this particular bill is significantly less than normal marijuana bills. If I were to take one of these packages and give it to you, that'd be a fifth-degree controlled substance crime. We carry a maximum penalty of 5 years in prison and up to a $10,000 fine. However, on this particular bill, if I were to do that, it'd be a 2-year felony and a $3,000 fine. Those are some of the concerns that law enforcement has, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next, I have Tom Pritchard, Jim Hackens, Jim Fruling, I think, and Ryan Rassen. So please come to the table, state your name for the record, and be mindful that we are trying to give equal time to everyone.
We'll be the last two to come up. So.
Okay, great. Thank you. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is James Fruling. I'd like to explain why I pulled this bill because of the danger that it poses to individuals and society. Marijuana is a dangerous drug. There are legitimate reasons why its use is criminalized in society. It's a mind-altering drug, so it impairs a person's judgment. It's extremely addictive, and it's a gateway drug to other drugs. I know this from personal experience. I started using drugs when I was 12. My sister introduced me to marijuana. I started selling marijuana when I was 13 to other kids, and over the next 23 years, I sold a lot of drugs, used a lot of drugs, and a major part of those were marijuana. The way this bill is written, it opens the door to significant abuse and thus harm for more people than it could conceivably help. If we were allowed to grow marijuana, we'd be supplying illegal drug dealers like what I used to be. When I was selling drugs, the brass ring was to find a marijuana grower. If you need something like good pot, you could write your own ticket. I could offer that person growing the marijuana either drugs or more money than they could get selling it to patients. If the grower agrees, then I'm in business. But if he refuses, that's okay too. Here's what would happen then. A few days later, his door would be kicked in with a couple guys with guns and masks, and they'd take the marijuana plants, kind of what they were just talking about there. And just to put in here, I never thought I'd really be agreeing with police officers, but I do agree with everything that they said. If I knew someone who had a prescription for the marijuana, I could simply offer them other drugs or money for that, and that's commonly done. I've done that for a number of years. Trust me, people will sell it. I have no doubt on this. So you see, having hundreds growing marijuana for medical purposes will make the job of a drug dealer a lot easier. Realize this bill allows an individual to possess 2.5 ounces of marijuana and growers to produce 12 plants per patient. 12 plants can produce over 30,000 joints over a year. This is far more than any person could need for medical use. In closing, I wish you would consider what this proposal will actually do to the health and the safety of people in their family and their children. It will send the wrong message to the young people about the danger of the drug. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Yes, my name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and we oppose it for most of the reasons already stated, so I won't reiterate those. But I just want to say that there was a study done in 2008 for over the years 2005 and 2006, and they found that medical marijuana states are 8 of the top 10 states with the highest percentages of young people who have used marijuana in the past year. They are the majority of the states in the top 10 for the first time use of marijuana and marijuana use in the past year. So I think we have to realize when you treat marijuana as medicine, I think you're obviously going to attempt to legitimize it in the eyes of young people. And that's our concern, that in a sense what you're saying now is a dangerous drug is now medicine, when in fact it can be used for a wide range of causes, not just the terminal one. So we are concerned about the message this sends to our young people and the effect it will have on our state. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Please come to the table, state your name for the record, and be mindful that 1 to 2 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim Stinziani, Vietnam veteran, graduate of the University of Minnesota, psychology, sociology. One thing we're missing here is the self-incorporated aspect of drugs. This is a foot-in-the-door operation under the guise of medicinal marijuana and harm reduction. If anybody's familiar with George Soros, mega speculator, billionaire, involved in Dope Incorporated, this is the biggest profitable business, bigger than oil in the country. Look into the history. These medical marijuana initiatives were funded by George Soros in California in 1996. He was involved in the funding in Arizona that same year. And he's also involved in funding a lot of marijuana operations. So please keep in mind the background of where these initiatives started and what they're trying to do globally on this situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Hamer. Yes, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Representative Rukavina.
Representative Rukavina, question.
Somebody called my file in front of a bunch of officers. I'm not doing a good job with your gun so far. But anyway, who took my head file?
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Mayor, Madam Chair, and members,
Representative Paymar has a question.
Go ahead.
Representative Paymar.
I'm just trying to, I would like to follow up on a comment and ask you to clarify it. The Commissioner of Public Safety made a comment about how wide open this bill is, and he said basically, and I quote one thing he said, that you could get a card and have your primary caregiver provide a prescription if you had shin splints, I think he said. But when I read the bill, it says you have to be a qualifying patient, and then when you look at what a qualifying patient is, you have to have a debilitating medical condition, and then when you look at what a debilitating medical condition is, you see that that's defined as cancer, glaucoma, acute immune deficiency syndrome, hepatitis, a debilitating disease or medical condition or treatment that produces one of the more of the following: wasting syndrome, intractable pain. I have that definition here in statute that that says what kinds of prescriptions or drugs can be used for intractable pain, severe not seizures, but not limited to those, characteristics of epilepsy, severe and persistent muscle spasm, multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, and HIV. So it seems to me like debilitating medical condition is fairly well spelled out. So is the commissioner right that you could have a little bruise or a splint or a shin splint and get and have medical marijuana?
Representative Rukavina.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, and Representative Paymar, as much as I like Michael Canton, he's not right at all. And in fact, intractable pain is described in statute, as you said, and it passed the House floor back, I think, in 1996 or 7 on 131-0 vote, including then Representative Palente's vote. So, no, he's not right. And I don't know, Michael, where you've been the last few months, but to say that the Food and Drug Administration has served his country well after the peanut butter fiasco, not to mention the recent talks about politicalization of the department, including today, is way out of line. And Mr. Bob Bushman, where are you?
Senator Rukavina, you need to talk into the microphone.
Mr. Bushman, I want him to look me in the eye and tell me if he has ever talked to me in his entire life.
I have.
When? But that's the only time, and I remember that time then when we had a bunch of you guys up there to protect the Russian and Soviet skiers at the time. Then that would be probably the only time I've ever talked to you, because nobody has ever asked me to talk about this bill since I have become the chief officer. No one.
Representative Rukavina,
is that true or not? What I just said.
I have not talked to you, but other members of our coalition.
No member of your coalition has ever talk to me. Has anybody in this room ever talked to me about this bill other than Mr. Canton the other day? Raise your hands if you're here. No one has ever talked to me about this bill. So, Mr. Bushman, what you said was not true. And regarding the marijuana that was put on the table, the drug DEA said that the average plant yields 0.22 pounds, and I think they're the only ones that can legally grow marijuana for medical purposes. So I don't know where all of this information came from either. Members, I want to say this. The only person, the only law enforcement person in this room who has ever operated as a law enforcement officer under a medical marijuana state is Mr. Norm Stamper. And he told you that he had no problems with it. And so, members, I want you to remember something as we vote today. This bill does nothing more than protect sick and dying Minnesotans who are using marijuana under a doctor's supervision from the threat of arrest or prosecution. It has nothing to do with criminal use of marijuana. It doesn't at all. So I'm asking you to be compassionate to the people like Joni Whiting who had to break the law, and be compassionate to those people and use a little reason here today, members, about this bill, because this, according to even the police chief from Seattle, is probably the toughest law that he's seen in the United States of America regarding the medical use of marijuana.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, I'd like to crack at the ex-chief, if I could, here, talk to him for a second.
Representative Cornish.
You're a former chief. I'm still a chief. Probably not the size sound much smaller, but I've spent my life as a career of law enforcement also.
Representative Cornish, it's hard to hear you. If you could try to speak into the microphone, I'm sure what you're going to say is important.
I hate these things. I'll just talk louder. I was amazed at the disrespect you showed the fellow officers here behind me here today when you said that their idea should be discounted. I would sure as hell take their word over any doctor in this state. They're the ones that come through the doors the first. They're the ones that see the problems of the families. They're the ones that turn the people over to the people that deal with these problems. We see it firsthand. We had a woman the other day in my town that said that she smoked marijuana for relief of pain. However, when we did the search warrant, we found traces of cocaine, a family running all over, and her friend coming down the street, DWI. The other day, I was asked to go if I wanted to go in a search warrant, and I chose to be the first one through the door. And as the person was beating the door in with a maul, and finally I had to kick it in, go in with our pistols drawn, say, get down, get down, get down, take the chance of shooting somebody with two pit bulls in the bay, it flashed through my head the reason we were there was from marijuana. So to say that marijuana is something so small and to discount why cops should have anything to say about it when we're the first ones on the line and rely on doctors, for goodness sake, a doctor will give you a tint prescription for a window without any thing was wrong with your eyes. He'll give you a permit for a crossbow without ever interviewing you. They give you prescriptions over the phone without ever seeing you. It's documented. So I'd much rather trust the word of a policeman. So how in the world can you discount your fellow colleagues like this and say that they shouldn't have as much to say about this?
Well, if I gave you that impression, I do apologize. I believe that law enforcement must be at the table. I think I mentioned that the conversation must include law enforcement. In the end, if we're talking about a medical issue, that's not our area of expertise. And I make no apologies for deferring to the medical community, to the public health and medical community, in deciding whether or not this particular drug is helpful for patients who cannot tolerate opioids, who are facing imminent death, who may be in dire pain. I think I would ask this question, who are we to say no to that?
Madam Chair?
Representative Cornish.
Well, who are we to say no? Well, we're the ones with the bulletproof vest, with the little flashlights on our heads going through the door while the doctor's sitting there with his white coat on writing out the little prescription. They're not taking the risk. We are. And when we open the door to marijuana, it's a precursor. When I go into these places, I've got cocaine and methamphetamine. You know what the first thing you see in the drawer? Marijuana. You know, when you talk to the people, the victims of this Holocaust, and nowadays with drugs and methamphetamine, what they started out as marijuana. So what you see is the relief of pain, which I've had all sorts of people die around me of cancer and debilitating disease. You couldn't even touch their bed of pain, but they weren't asking for a marijuana. There's lots of other drugs. So I'm just saying you should take into account more to the law enforcement perspective, the ones that are actually taking the risk, and not the doctors on up the chain that deal with the social.
I have a couple of
small oral amendments that I'm hoping that we will allow.
Representative Cornish, we actually have some written amendments as well for members, and so maybe if you could write them out so we can make sure staff get some.
Well, just one word, actually. I'd rather save all that hassle. Like we've been doing, I think you've allowed small oral
amendments. I have small, non-controversial oral amendments, Representative Cornish.
I don't think they're controversial.
anyways, Mr. Stamper, did you want to reply? Otherwise, we do have other questions.
I did, and I'll make this very brief. I have nothing but the deepest respect for our frontline police officers, many of whom, by the way, support medical marijuana. I have spoken to hundreds of them in the last 4 years. I think the situation you're describing represents an illicit market. That market has existed for decades. It has, in fact, put the police in a situation where they are the first responders, where they work the undercover cases, where they develop the snitches, where they, in fact, hit the homes and jeopardize their lives going in. I have nothing but the deepest respect for them. what has been described here by the law enforcement community is our current state of affairs with respect to drug policy. What we're suggesting, what I'm suggesting here, is that medical marijuana helps to properly legitimize a portion of that field, which I believe makes law enforcement's job easier and safer. We have not had a single drug ripoff of a medical marijuana patient or caregiver in the state of Washington that I'm aware of. Not a single drug ripoff. And I think that's pretty impressive.
Representative Cole.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is clearly a high-charged issue, and it's not an easy issue, I don't think, for many of us sitting around this table. I'm going to try to ask a bunch of questions of Representative Rookavina. I'm going to try to make them short, and I'm not trying to play the game here, Representative Rookavina. I have some concerns about the legislation. Let's start with Section 1. Can you, Representative Rookavina, the way that we're treating the data practices issues under this bill is different than a bill that's currently moving through, and I actually have some concerns about the bill that's moving through, but different than a bill that's moving through with regard to law enforcement's ability to access the pseudoephedrine logs that pharmacies have in light of the meth bill that we passed a few years ago. Mr. Bushman was here earlier testifying in support of that bill. What we're doing here is different. Can you tell me why? What's the policy reason, Representative Rookavina, as to why we should prevent law enforcement from having access to information of more information around who has these who's allowed to use medical marijuana?
Madam Chair,
Representative Rookavina.
Representative Coles, as I've mentioned to you and others on more than one occasion, I'm not an attorney, nor have I aspired to be one. So if I can call up Ms. Heather Ozzie, who is the attorney for Minnesotans for Compassionate Care, to answer your legal questions.
Well, and Madam Chair, that's...
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, that's fine with me. I wasn't trying to ask the legal question. I was trying to understand the policy distinction, if there is one. I'm not... Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. I'm sincere, Representative Rookavina. I'm not trying to play a game here.
Representative Rookavina.
And Madam Chair, and nor am I. I mean, under current HIPAA law, I think it's all... Your medical records and that are private data, so... And this would be a medical use.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rookavina, that'll be fine for now, I guess. We can talk about that one further. Let me ask you, Representative Rookavina, maybe you know or maybe your witness knows. How many, Section 2, Subdivision 12, the written certification, how many, and I seriously don't know this, how often are prescriptions written by a physician that last more than a year or, 12 months? It's basically, so if you go see a doctor, you can get a prescription for 12 months or a permission for 12 months, and you don't have to go back and see the doctor at any kind of interval other than 12 months. I don't know if that's common or not.
Madam Chair, I can only give you my experience, and I had to go to the doctor last week, and because the pharmacist told me it had been 3 years, and I had to go back to the doctor. So, and it wasn't Viagra either. Representative Cole, so.
I didn't ask and didn't want to know.
So 3 years for me. I can only answer personally on that.
Representative Cole.
I'll follow up with the advocates on that, Madam Chair. Section 3, is there a reason, Representative Rookavina, as I look at the end at 3.25, there's nothing that requires the patient in the language to purchase marijuana from a registered organization. Would you or the advocates object to putting that language, something along the lines of, at the very end there, and that was purchased from a registered organization? It would probably need to go there and probably need to go on line 3.33 as well.
Representative Rookavina.
I don't, where you're at there. Oh, but marijuana is going to exceed an allowable amount. And you want...
I'm just suggesting, Representative Rookavina, that you might be able to take care of some of my concerns and some other members' concerns if we limit where you can purchase the marijuana from. Right now, your bill doesn't limit it. You have these registered organizations that exist, but there's nothing that prevents somebody from going and purchasing that marijuana on the street, for example. Take a look at that, Representative Rookavina, and think about it. I think that might make your bill a little better and maybe a little more palatable. One last question. I think this goes a little bit to what you were talking about, Representative Paymar. Representative Lucavina, I'd encourage you to take a look at Section 7 of your bill, and that's the affirmative defense. As I read that, I'm not a criminal lawyer. I'm not even a practicing litigator any longer. But as I read that, Representative Lucavina, if I am arrested for the possession or some kind of marijuana crime, I can use that defense if I can find a doctor to say that it's useful to me to have marijuana. I don't have to already have that prior to being arrested. I can just go find a doctor afterwards, and if it's if I can find that doctor, this says I have an affirmative defense and my case is going to get thrown out. I'm not sure if that's what's intended or not, but if it's not, I think that needs to be tightened up.
Representative Rivina.
Madam Chair, 9 of the 13 current states have that in law. And so I will talk to you about that later, but we can try to discuss that.
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, this is a tough issue, and I do think there's some problems with the bill as it's currently written. I'm gonna be voting no today, but I'm not sure that my concerns are going to be able to be addressed. But I think there is a way to tighten this up a little more, and I think we might be able to. Address some of the public safety concerns. We may not be able to address them all, but I appreciate the time. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Rivina.
All right. It's my understanding that we have a few other questions, but there are two amendments that we know of, and so I'm hoping that we can at least deal with the amendments, and then we'll finish up with questions. Okay? Representative Bingham, it's my understanding you have an amendment.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do. At this point, I'd like to move the A5 amendment.
Okay, members, the A5 amendment. Representative Bingham, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Rucavina, the one concern, my major concern about the whole idea behind this is the growing aspect of it. And for the sake of keeping the comments short, I will say, and no pun intended, what my amendment does is currently a bill has for the possession or whatever of 12 plants. I would like to move that down to 6. And the 1.5 line on the amendment currently in your bill, you are allowing people who are more than 5 miles away to grow their own. And I want to do 30 miles. And the premise behind that is that currently HMOs use 30 miles as their mark to be from a provider. So with that, I would, if anybody has questions about the amendment, but
Representative Rivina.
Madam Chair, I accept the 30 as I agree with the logic there, and the 6 is up to the committee.
All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And next, Representative Kelly, I believe you have an amendment. It's the A6.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to offer the A6 amendment.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Rivina, a couple of items. First of all, this is the third time I'm hearing this bill, and I've been back and forth, and I've tried to keep an open mind. I think in the first committee, I started thinking I was for it and ended up voting against it. But a couple of the items, I do agree with law enforcement. I thought it was too not tight enough. So in trying to come up with my own compromise, first of all, allowing the primary caregiver to go from 18 to 21, that's item 1.2. But the next part of this amendment, a sunset provision. And I guess this comes out of all this discussion that we're having, is to allow a two-year sunset, which would allow us to put this kind of in a petri dish and have us come back to it to say if all of these issues, whether they were bad or good, came out, we would have the ability to address them then and have this discussion again and see if what we're doing is the right thing to do. But in order to have that sunset provision, so it expires October 1st, we actually have to have a start date, so that's why the line item 1.7, 1.9 actually has a start date of October 1st. I understand the law going to affect August 1st, that gives the Department of Health 2 months basically to get up and running. So that would be my amendment.
Representative Rivina.
Well, Madam Chair, members, Representative Kelly, I'm a little concerned about the amount of time it's going to take the Department of Health to establish the whole process, but given the fact that you've got a date in there that they have to have it done by, I suppose I'll just say, let the committee do what it wants. On the 18 to 21 year old, that would be fine with me. But members, you know, I don't think any state has repealed this. In fact, there's been no attempt by any state at all to repeal it. And in fact, as Chief Stamper mentioned, or someone did, the Montana, that are actually increasing the amount. But the committee has to do what it has to do.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right, next for questions, Representative Cornish.
Should I try that amendment now?
A
non-controversial bill,
okay.
One word apiece.
Okay, well, if it's not controversial, we'll consider it. So why don't you tell us what it is, and then I'll let you know.
Well, Madam Chair and members, this law creates penalties provisions, and they're not nearly severe enough for existing statutes, and it'll negatively impact the ability of the prosecutors to get a worthwhile sentence. So mine would have to do with the penalty phase of bringing it up to what a Schedule I drug is, and just making it common sense instead of these penalties you got. So the first one would be on page 10, on line 10.18, and change the 2 to a 5, and on line 10.19, right below it, the 3,000 to a 10,000. The next place you find it is on page 14, and the last line on page 14, 14.36, change the 2 to a 5. And then on page 15, the top line, 15.1, change the 3 to 10, which seemed like it would be in accordance with where it should be currently in statute.
Members, we do have a 24-hour rule, and what I've been doing is waiving it when amendments are considered non-controversial, and we've talked to both sides. So if anyone objects to that amendment, I will not consider it because, again, it didn't meet the 24-hour deadline. So, Representative Rukavina, would you consider that a controversial amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, my understanding is that the penalties in this bill are much more severe than the actual possession amounts that currently are in place for criminal possession of marijuana, if I'm not mistaken. And so, given the fact that even a smidgen of, somebody giving it illegally or whatever is a felony, or it would probably be a petty misdemeanor for that type of possession under current law, I think it's a pretty substantial amendment myself. But, it's up to committee. I'm not a committee member. So.
Does anyone of the members object?
Madam Chair.
Representative Paymar?
I just don't know. I mean, I haven't had a chance to think it through, but I'm just wondering, now are we getting to the point where this bill needs a fiscal note, or change in the fiscal note? I don't know what this is actually doing, but...
Representative Paymar, it does need to go to finance, and so Representative Cornish, would you consider considering that in finance, because I'm certain it's probably going to come to public safety finance, and you're on that committee.
Public safety finance?
I believe that it's going to end up in...
regular finance.
It's just going to regular finance?
Well, if regular finance, Representative Rukavina's on that committee. I think there's about much chance of him considering it there as there is here.
Representative Cornish, just to be fair, I do think that this is a controversial amendment because people don't understand what the implications might be. And we do have a 24-hour rule, and I have been trying to be very lenient and waive them when we can, and so... I guess I'd ask you to work with the author between now and its next stop and see if you can't figure it out.
Well, I don't think I'll have much of a choice on that issue.
All right. Thanks, Representative Cornish. All right. Next, there was a question of Representative Ruskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Madam Chair, I'd request a roll call when we do vote on the bill.
Okay.
Then I have a question for Representative Rukavina. Representative, on the bottom of page 2, under primary caregiver, the last sentence there, a primary caregiver may assist no more than 5 qualifying patients. I guess I was curious as to, as I understand, this is usually a family member who is helping somebody who is at home under a terminal condition, that type of thing. I would expect there's probably only going to be
one terminal patient in the home at one time under most circumstances. Is there a reason to have more than one there, and what is the reason for five?
Representative Rukavina.
Well, Madam Chair, well, sometimes no one has a family member to take care of, so there are people that in other states that have helped in this regard, and so that's my understanding as to why that we have up to five. You know, a lot of people have no one to take care of them when they get ill.
Representative Duskowski.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess Representative Rukavina, my concern there is, of course, that that's another place where the bill seems to have a wide open area, or an area that could be abused. I would expect under that scenario that one person would also qualify if there's one patient and one caregiver. I think they could take care of that.
Well, I could discuss that with Representative Duskowski as if the bill moves on, but other states, most other states have no limit on how many patients a caregiver can take care of. So.
Thank you.
All right. Chair, clerk will take the roll.
Representative Holstrom.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Jim.
Aye.
Representative Cornish.
No.
Representative Duskowski.
No.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Taft.
No.
Representative Perry.
Aye.
Representative Coolidge Jackson.
Aye.
Representative Coles.
No.
Representative West. Representative Mason.
Aye.
Representative Mallory.
Aye.
Representative Owen. Representative Paymar.
Aye.
Representative Rosenthal.
Aye.
And Representative Szymanski.
No.
Nine in favor, six opposed. The motion passes. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Member.
Representative Paymar. Representative Paymar.
Where's the bill going?
Finance.
Tony?
That was Paulson. Next on the agenda, it's my understanding, is Representative Adkins in the room? Did he walk out? Representative Mariani, please come to the table. The chair moves that House File 988 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Justice. Representative Mariani, please be mindful that we are supposed to, you know, get done so education can... So please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I will give you my super condensed version of this. Most, but not all, members in this committee were part of the last legislative session.
We're trying to continue the meeting. Please take your comments outside. Representative Mariani.
Most, but certainly not all members of this committee were part of the last legislative session where we extensively debated the Real ID issues at least twice in the floor of the House because we passed Real ID prohibitions of participation twice off the floor of the House last session as did the Senate. The bills were subsequently vetoed by the governor, which then also produced a gubernatorial executive order calling for the state of Minnesota not to abide by Real ID, except for some possible, in my opinion, quite frankly, kind of mushy language and the conditions under which it could. Nonetheless, the executive order is set to expire in June of this year. Real ID federally extends all the way out to December. Members, Real ID, in very short language, is essentially a national unfunded mandate that invites a ton of huge civil rights, privacy law, privacy rights issues by virtue of creating a national ID card backed up by a national database. It also, frankly, members, as a state legislator, this is one of the things I also find most egregious about the coercive nature sometimes of our federal government, it also basically takes away from you, from us, the rights that are conferred to states relative to issuing and prescribing the conditions under which driver's licenses are issued, and so we would in essence conform our state driver's licenses to federal standards, which will perpetually be subject to actions on the part of the federal government at any time, regardless of what your desires would be. And so, members, there's so much I want to say, but I know you've been a long hearing, and so I'm just going to keep it very concise. The bill basically bars the state of Minnesota from participating in the Real ID federal scheme. As you know, there's a new federal administration. I am told that there are, as of this point, no funds affiliated any longer at the federal level with Real ID. The only thing that remains is this mandate to states. We do know that our Homeland Security Director, Commissioner, Secretary was the, so a few months ago, the governor of Arizona, which is one of 11 states that has passed a ban of state participation in Real ID, an order that she signed. Nonetheless, she is, the law is still in the book. She is in a position to have to interpret states' participation with Real ID mandates. There are real consequences for a state not to participate in the Real ID, mostly having to do with our citizens being denied access to airline travel, access to federal courthouses, and access to nuclear power plants. It is up to the commissioner and the secretary to determine whether or not any of the 11, and I hear there's a 12th state that now currently has a ban on the governor's desk, Virginia. It's up to the secretary to determine what level of compliance there exists. It is my argument, I think it should be our argument, that the Minnesota driver's license is a safe and secure mechanism. It has been acknowledged as such by the industry standards, and I can't remember the name of the group. I'll pull it up in a second. It is my belief that we meet the security requirements that have compelled Washington initially to create this effort, even though I think it's an overreach effort in its implications.
Representative Mariani, I'm going to cut you off here a little bit and just let members know that the reason why this is in our jurisdiction, it really needs to go to civil law.
Yes.
But the reason why it's here is because it directs the Commissioner of Public Safety to do something. And so that really is the reason why it's here. Or actually it directs the Commissioner of Public Safety not to do something. And so this really is more within the realm of the Civil Law Committee and with in the jurisdiction of transportation. But the Commissioner is here, and so I just felt that if he wanted to make some comments, he doesn't want to make any comments. So members, if you have questions kind of related to what really belongs in this committee, if we could keep it to that. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mariani, I apologize. Representative Rukavina was still trying to lobby me on the last bill, and so I missed the beginning of your introduction to the bill. Can you comment? I seem to recall that the governor issued some kind of executive order last year, or some type of statement with regard to this. Can you remind me what that was and where things sit with the governor on this issue?
Representative Mariani.
The governor's executive order is set to expire in June of this year. It also would prohibit the state of Minnesota from participating in the Real ID scheme. However, there are broad caveats within the executive order. I don't know where the governor's position is at this point relative to this proposal. However, members, I would again remind us that an executive order is not in the same permanent bearing that would lie in the actions that we take in terms of passing laws in statute. I think this is an important enough issue that the legislature should exercise that prerogative, and I have every hope that the governor, this time around, under changed conditions, most notably that monies are no longer tied to Real ID implementations, would be much more favorable, but I don't know that for a fact.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment. Representative Mariani, I think, you know, the legislature's in a bit of a catch-22 here. I tend to agree with you on the policy, and I get frustrated time and time again with the federal government forcing us to do certain things, whether it's this or No Child Left Behind or whatever it may be. That said, I am very concerned about my constituents' ability to be able to travel across the country and to go to airports and go in and out of airports, and so there are some real issues with regard to whether we're going to comply and whether we're going to get a waiver from our compliance. And so I'm going to support your bill going out of here today, but it's not without some reservation, because I think that I'm concerned about my constituents' ability to get around the country, and if that's hindered because of what we do as a legislature, we're going to hear from a lot of them about that as well. And I don't like what the federal government's done, but we got to be mindful of the impact on our constituents as well.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, what are the costs to the state of Minnesota if we don't go along with the BLID? I know that, you know, it's an unfunded mandate, but what other things are associated with this that might happen to the state?
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, first of all, there are costs, certainly costs affiliated with going along with the Real ID, because of our need to redesign our driver's license, both the tool and the process by which we secure that tool according to these federal standards. We're looking at roughly $12 million of one-time upfront implementation and roughly around $19 million of ongoing implementation over the course of the next, I think it was 5 years, related to this. I suspect that there'll be increasing pressure for us to either pass that along in the form of increased driver's license fees to the citizens of Minnesota, or to raise taxes in some manner to be able to cover those costs. In terms of the costs related to noncompliance, I think the issues are less than costs and more the issues that Representative Cole has identified in terms of the rights that, at least in under federal statute, citizens could potentially be denied based on a ruling from the Commissioner or the Secretary of Homeland Security.
Right. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You have somebody else that wants to testify?
Madam Chair, members, my name is, state your name for the record. Joan Kaczynski, I'm the Driver Services Director with the Department of Public Safety. To speak to your question about the cost to the state, I don't have any information as far as what costs would be incurred or what the penalties would be for the state. I do know that as of, and let me check my notes, as of January 1st, 2010, if we are not compliant with the Real ID Act, our citizens will not be able to fly or go through security without secondary and additional checks.
All right, Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, interesting that could be a costly venue if we go in this direction. But Representative Mariani, if we were to go along with it, what is the return on the investment that we, if it's going to cost us $19 million and we're going to put it in, what's the, I was just in bioscience when we were talking about things there with technology and different things there, and Representative Norton asked for a bill to come up with some deed to give for the cost of unemployment and all this kind of, to give us an idea from the state standpoint, what is our return on investment for the dollars we put into something like this? Is there some kind of a dollar figure or some kind of figure that you can look at to say, by going with this Real ID, we're going to get a good return on investment, or is it just a feel-good type situation?
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, and Representative Anderson, you posed the same questions I would pose to the architects of the Real ID. The purpose of this legislation is to say that we're not going to participate in the Real ID. I think there have been arguments made on the part of its architects why we need this to make the nation more safe. I think it's fraught with all sorts of severe issues, including cost issues, but also civil liberties issues, and I think there's a better and different way for us to get at the issue we need to get at. Chair of Members, it is up to the Secretary of Homeland Security to determine whether or not the states are in fact, she's got the discretion, the states are in fact in compliance with UID provisions. Obviously, I'm not a seer. I can look into the future, but I am hard-pressed to understand how someone who is the governor of a state who signed off on a statute barring her own state from participating in Real ID would now subsequently turn around and attempt to enforce those same actions of the Real ID on the 11, potentially 12, and maybe 13 states that are now coming forward and saying we're not going to participate. But I think your questions are great. I'm not here to defend Real ID. I think it's a very flawed approach.
All right. The chair renews her motion that House File 988 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Civil Justice Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. It's my understanding that Representative Atkins' bill has compromised, that it's going to take just a minute. So, Representative Atkins, are you in the room? All right. I will move that House File 1805 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommendation with a re-referral to Public Safety Finance, and I believe that you have an amendment, so I will move the A090228 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for missing the call earlier. I was actually in the hallway trying to swim through the fish moving the other way on the...
Swim faster, Representative
yeah,
Atkins.
We do have peace in the firehouse, Madam Chair. We've got the professional firefighters, full-time firefighters, volunteer firefighters all on the same page. This provides for licensing of firefighters. There'll be grandparented in as of July 1, 2011, everybody that's a full-time firefighter gets a certification from their chief or training officer that says they're full-time. That will qualify them for the license. Volunteers are also able to get licensed should they so choose. The same board that provides for the certification, and that is the, I want to make sure that I get the name right, the Fire Training and Education Board is the one that provides the licensing. They take care of that. Everybody, as far as I know, is on board, and I'm aware of no opposition. I'd appreciate your support.
All right, Representative Bingham. Anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 1805 be recommended to pass and be re-referred as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Nelson, are you still in the room? Can you do it in a couple minutes? Representative Nelson, I will move that House File 1791 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Representative Nelson, be aware that education is waiting for us to get out.
I will do this quick. With all the discussions that are, thank you for hearing us today. With all the discussions that are going on with possible mergers of different local government units, cities, counties, whatever, this bill has brought to me because there's some concern about police officers and correction officers that are currently working for these agencies, that they have accrued sick time and they have accrued vacation time that and seniority that they've worked on, and this has been part of their pay that has been negotiated with their package. And the concern is that if we merge these two departments together, what happens to the sick time? And what this bill does is, if, say, New Hope and Crystal, and there's two cities close to my legislative district, were to merge their police department, that the sick leave and the vacation time that the existing officers have would fall into the new department, whichever that is. This also covers counties if they were to merge, if some of the discussions that have gone on, their correctional officers that are in the prison, that the sick leave and the vacation time and the seniority they have accrued would follow with them. And that's all this bill does. There is no cost, should be no cost to it, because they've already paid for this out of the wages, the reduction in the wages that they've already earned. This is stuff that these officers have already earned in their current service.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill?
Yeah, Madam Chair,
My
name is Dennis Flaherty, and I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which is the largest ranked and file association in the state. We brought this bill to Representative Nelson in view of the fact that we're living in an environment, as you know better than I, for local government and county government, et cetera, is going to be all about mergers, consolidations. I know that when I, a few years back, I was involved in the merger of the Ramsey County Communication Center. You've seen Dakota County merge. You're going to see a move by counties and cities to consolidate. And unfortunately, as I speak this afternoon, there's nothing that would provide this kind of protection to the members that we represent, police officers, police dispatchers, jail employees. So as Representative Nelson pointed out, this is something that this type of protection is currently in the law for a number of industries, from court employees to school district employees to employees of the Metropolitan Council, bus drivers. And so we're certainly for, and we'll always be at the table for efficiencies in government and mergers and consolidations when they make sense, but we'd like to make sure our employees are represented.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering why we have to have a special law for this. Why can't they just, on their own and within their own jurisdiction, come together and form their own without having to have a law?
Representative.
Because they would have nothing to safeguard. They might have a collective bargaining agreement that spells it out with the current employer, but then when they merge and become an employee of a newly created entity or an existing entity other than their own, the protections and safeguards that they have would be null and void. And so that's why it's essential that the state law provide that protection.
All right. With that, the chair lays over House File 1791 for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill. Members, put the rest of your papers in your packet. And with that, this meeting is recessed. We will reconvene at 6:15 in room 400 North. We're going to call the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee to order. Members, if you'll bear with me, I have the first two bills on the agenda, so I'm going to chair and present at the same time. So, without objection. So I would move that House File 1405 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. Please come to the table. That's right. Members, this is an agency bill, and so I'm going to let them talk about what it is and what it does. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rick Walter. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue, and I'm here to present House File 1405. Let me start out by saying that the general rule of tax data classification is that anything to do with the taxpayer's case, even who the taxpayer is classified as private data under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 270B. The law we're amending here, that we propose to amend here today, is an exception to that rule, and that law currently allows the Department of Revenue to disclose to law enforcement authorities whenever we believe that a taxpayer is making a threat of death or physical injury to any person, including a Department of Revenue employee. What this amendment that we are proposing does, it adds a new authority to disclose to law enforcement when one of our Department of Revenue employees is being harassed by a taxpayer to the point where it reaches the elements of criminal harassment under MnSTAT Section 609.749, which we have taken the elements, the basic elements of that law, and added them to this amendment.
Excuse me. I will move the A090214 amendment to get the bill in the state. If you also would like it, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I'll speak to how the bill reads with that amendment that just passed. The bill is limited to disclosing circumstances of harassment to situations where we believe that a Department of Revenue employee is being harassed by a taxpayer to the point where it reaches criminal harassment, as I said. The elements of which we took from 609.749. So that's one limitation to this bill. And the other limitation is that we are only allowed to disclose limited information initially to law enforcement, which is the name, address, and phone number of the individual who's doing the harassing, the name of the employee who's being harassed, and the nature and circumstances of the harassment. And we believe this amendment is very necessary and reasonable because oftentimes harassment can escalate into the more serious circumstance of threat of death or physical injury. And that concludes my presentation.
Questions from members? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If this goes to a court case, who's going to be the one that's going to be... Is law enforcement going to have to prove this harassment situation or what? I don't see how this is going to all work.
Mr.
Walden. Madam Chair, Representative... We believe that what the police will do initially is simply get in touch with the taxpayer and warn them to stop this behavior. We think most cases will be resolved that way. If law enforcement winds up doing their own investigation, then It will be up to the county attorney to prosecute any criminal harassment that they believe might exist. But the purpose of this law is to protect our employees. It's not necessarily to have anybody prosecuted.
So, Madam Chair, to the testifier, the county attorney in the county in which the person is bringing forth or harassing from, is that who's going to be bringing forth the charges?
Mr. Walter.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, if any charges are brought, it will be in the county where the taxpayer resides. But again, I would state that this is not a criminal provision per se. It's merely a provision to help us protect our employees.
Representative Anderson?
Well, Madam Chair, I just see this as just, you're putting something on the county attorney that they're, I mean, you're asking them to do something that you're adding another cost to their schedule already, and it's like it's an unfunded mandate, and I'm not sure if this is all what it's supposed to be.
Representative Anderson, if I might clarify a little bit, this actually came as part of the presentation that came from the governor for the tax committee, and we took this out separately. And what this is simply saying is that the Department of Revenue has the ability to tell law enforcement if someone is harassing one of their folks that they, in fact, have something going on with the Department of Revenue. And so this doesn't get into prosecuting them for harassment after. It's just the release of the data. Because right now, there's no, you can't make the case for why someone is or isn't harassing someone that works for the Department of Revenue. Because you can't disclose the fact that they've got a case that's ongoing. Does that clarify it at all, Representative
Anderson? No, that's a little bit ticklish. Okay.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, I renew my motion that House File 1405 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Taxes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passed. Thank you.
Representative Hilton, would you like to move your bill, House File 1397?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 1397 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill.
To your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With me is Hennepin County, and this was brought to me by them, and so I will turn it over to them, Madam Chair. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mark Thompson. I'm the Hennepin County District Court Administrator. Here before you to talk about House File 1397, which is essentially a piece of legislation that cleans up previously existing old municipal court language and brings Hennepin County's language concerning the location of court facilities in conformance with what was done with Ramsey County's language years ago. That is, the majority of the judges of the district shall decide where court will be held. Typically, this is in consultation with the county boards, who by statute are the provider of the facilities that we use.
And that's it, Madam Chair. Any questions from members? Anybody in the audience like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over House. Well, oh, do you want to renew your motion, Madam Chair? Okay, great. You want to do your other bill, Madam Chair? 1498. Yes, Madam Chair, I would move House 1498. Recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Committee. And I think maybe you have an amendment. Yes, Madam Chair, I have an amendment. I don't want the number of amendments. I don't have a copy yet either, Madam Chair. I think it is Amendment DE1. Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the DE1 to put the bill in the form that the author would like it. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So your bill is amended. Thank you, Madam Chair. The background is that the legislature previously mandated that the DOC do a report on driving while impaired felonies in Minnesota. This report was mandated in the Minnesota Session Law 2002, and the report examines the implementation and effects of the Minnesota Felony Driving While Impaired Law that was enacted in August 1st of 2002. The report has been done for 5 years, and in 2007 will be the last year for the report. I believe that report needs to continue. Minnesota driving while impaired felony continues to spark interest and concern from the public as well as from members of both sides of the aisle. It is important that we continue to receive these reports and have the most accurate and accountable information on offenders be put in the DOC facilities for DWI. According to the DOC, we have 620 men and 43 women in our state correctional facilities for felony DWI, and the average sentence length for these 663 offenders is 49 months. It is important that we continue to receive information about these offenders so that the legislature and the public can examine and evaluate the policy provisions that we enacted in 2002. And that's it, Madam Chair. Are there any questions for Representative Anderson?
Madam Chair, Representative Hilton, this is bill's going to be laid over and possible inclusion in this, or is it going on the Finance Committee?
This one's going on to Finance because anytime you do a report, it has a cost, and this was a previous report that they were doing, and you could argue that it's going to have a cost.
Madam Chair?
Representative Anderson.
Representative Hilstrom, do you know what that cost was in previous years?
I don't. And Representative Anderson, that's why it's going to the Finance Committee. I don't know. We can get that information for you.
Okay.
Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilstrom, do you know, does the department have a position on this? I see them here, but I don't, if you know what it is, they don't have to come up. And
well, they probably want to come up, Representative Cole, because I think they'd rather not be doing these reports.
Madam Chair,
Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, let me, before I ask my question to the department,
I'm not sure that we should be continuing these reports every year myself. I think it's good for us, importantly, we had a discussion in Representative Paymark's committee this morning about per diem and the need for information, but when we have, when we've got serious budget problems like we do, some of these things that are nice to have and are helpful, you know, maybe should be put on the shelf for a year or two. And so, Representative Hillstrom, I like the information. It helps me as a policymaker try to make good decisions. But I guess I would be curious if the department has a position on it. This is one that I think at least for a year or two we should consider you know, putting on the shelf.
Representative Coles, I would bet that if this costs money, which I'm certain the fiscal note will, it's my understanding that Representative Paymar doesn't have money in his committee, so I'm hoping that we can pass the policy thing. We think that these are a good idea and that at some point we may not be able to do them.
Madam Chair, just if the department has a comment, I'd appreciate hearing it.
Okay. Representative Anderson? Oh, wait, did you... Just state your name for the record. I was, for the record, going to ask if there's anybody with testify on the bill. But we can do it now. Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lynn Dingle. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. And given the situation, if we don't get cut in our IT and research department, we don't have any objection to this.
Representative Coles, do you have any comments on that comment?
Good luck to all of us.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier from the department, so this information you've been ongoing for, what, 4 or 5 years, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, I was saying hi to Alice over there. Go ahead, Madam Chair. Ms. Dingle.
Members, yes, we have done this in the past, so I don't believe that it's a hardship to continue to do it with our current resources.
Yes, Madam Chair, so I guess in response to the fact that we don't do this, you'll still have the ongoing figures year in and year out, and even if it's not a report that's coming back to us, you'll have the figures available in your department.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
It's automated.
Any other questions? Okay, at this time, is there anybody in the audience that wishes to testify on the bill? Please turn your phones off. They're interfering. All right, Representative Hilton, would you like to renew your motion as amended?
I would move that House File 1498 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee with the recommendation of the publication.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
Motion carries. Representative Lash, are you in the room?
Yes.
Representative Lash, would you like to move adoption of the division report on House File 1043, 1618, 1636, 1605, 1768, and 1461?
I would do so, Madam Chair.
Representative West moves adoption of the division report. All those in, is there any discussion on those reports? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Johnson, your bill is first from that committee. So Representative Johnson moves that House File 1043 be laid over for possible inclusion in the public safety policy omnibus bill. Representative Johnson, it's my understanding you have an amendment.
That's correct, Madam Chair, and that amendment is A1. I'd like to move that amendment.
Representative Johnson moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Johnson.
Members, what this bill simply does is for those folks who have had problems with the law and now are trying to get reintegrated back into society by getting a job, and the first line in the bill pretty much says it all. A public employer may not inquire into or consider the criminal record of an applicant for public employment until the applicant has been selected for an interview. So it's directed solely at public employment, and the idea is to get folks in the door for the possibility of an interview. Once they have the interview, Once they are accepted as an applicant, then you can do the background check and see what's going on with respect to that. And there's some carve-outs as well. The Department of Corrections and public employers have a statutory duty to conduct a criminal background. And then you'll also note that the amendment that was added on, that was to provide comfort language for the League of Minnesota Cities and the Association of Minnesota Counties, so that if someone was applying for a job like an accountant, for example, they could notify the applicants that if you have a history of felony theft, you're probably not a good fit. So that, in some members, is the bill.
Question for members. Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, is there somebody from the Department of Corrections here to testify? Or does it, I should say public safety.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill?
I guess not. My concern, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, my concern is the compromise of public safety on this. And just thought if you know of any thoughts or any ideas of, would you think this would have any bearing on compromising of safety issues?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that's always a good point, and I think that was a concern of some folks initially when the bill first came out, and that's why we added on the Senate side, after discussion with the Department of Corrections, item B, where it says it doesn't apply to Department of Corrections or to public employers who have to do a criminal background check as part of what the job entails. So we did try to make sure that those bases were covered, and people seem to be satisfied with that.
All right. Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, and Representative Johnson, just so I understand, I think I do, this doesn't prohibit a public employer from doing a criminal background check. It prohibits them from doing the background check prior to selecting somebody as somebody they're intending to interview, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, that's correct. Just get the person's foot in the door and then do the check.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, if the City of Victoria has a position open, New Parks and Rec, maybe that's a bad thing to do with kids, but maybe a criminal background check requirements, but a public works director position, and they decide they want to interview four people, prior to those interviews, they can do the criminal background check on those four people once they've narrowed down the pool of 25 applicants to four, correct?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions? Seeing none, the chair lays over House File 1043 for possible inclusion in the public safety omnibus bill as amended. Next, Representative Clark, are you in the room? Chair moves House File 1636 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommendation and re-referral to the Housing Finance and Policy and Public Health Finance Division. Representative Clark, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is dealing with basically assistance to victims of sex trafficking and creating a grant program that does a couple of different things and awards grants to some of our local government and tribes, other nonprofit governmental services to provide providers of including housing, emergency shelter, and some of the kind of support services that are needed. And there is a special effort in this bill to make sure that we're serving the American Indian women who are a particular victim of this trafficking that we've been discovering recently. I have a couple of witnesses that I'd like to have them speak to the bill basically on that. Please go ahead, state your name for the record.
My name is Mary Ellison. I'm a staff attorney with the Advocates for Human Rights. This bill that you have before you, House File 1636, is modeled after the Battered Women's Program. It creates a permanent infrastructure for support of trafficking victims. It would be administered by the Office of Justice Programs in the manner much like the Battered Women's Program, where it would be a competitive grant process where organizations that have the expertise to serve victims of trafficking would apply for the grants to then provide services, including housing and other services that trafficking victims need. According to the Office of Justice Programs in the state, we have had 731 trafficking victims over a three-year period, and those would be the individuals we would envision using the services that would be provided by the organization. And
Madam Chair, Representatives, my name is Suzanne Keplinger. I'm the Executive Director at the Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center in Minneapolis, and we strongly support this initiative, House File 1636. We do provide direct services at this time to American Indian women who have been trafficked into sexual slavery. Currently out at the Adult Correctional Facility in Plymouth, there's a disproportionate number of American Indian women, but also African American and other women who have been repeatedly arrested on prostitution charges. What we're learning is that a large majority of these women were trafficked into prostitution as juveniles. We also know that when they leave the workhouse, if they don't have a safe place to go and they don't have support services, they're very likely to go back to their pimps or back to the street. So this is a revolving door of the criminal justice system, constantly picking these women up, putting them in the workhouse, and they're released again back to their pimps or to the streets. We need to provide them with a safe place to lay their head. We need to give them chemical dependency treatment, mental health care, all the range of services that they need. And in the end, this will be a cost savings because we will stop that revolving door of the criminal justice system intervening with women who have been victimized and should not be criminalized.
Just one more point, Madam Chair and committee members. The reason that we've included the services piece of our package of bills also is because it's so interrelated to the criminal provisions. What we know from doing research, and our organization published a report called the Sex Trafficking Needs Assessment for the state of Minnesota last fall. It was something that came out of a legislative mandate. What we know from publishing that report and doing the research is that unless the trafficking victims have services, they're not as likely to be able to even get to a point where they can cooperate in the prosecution of the sex traffickers. So that is why all of these bills are so interrelated and why we're here to talk about services in addition to the criminal penalties, which we'll talk about in a little while.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Clark, this bill is very broad and very, it's got a lot of areas that have to be covered, and have you had any chance to talk with public safety about being able to implement? You're asking the commissioner here to develop plans and consultation with non-governmental organizations, and it's just, it's got a lot of good things in it, but it's just so, I don't know if the department has the wherewithal to do all this and the finances to do all this. I just wondered if you've had chance to talk with him about this.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, in fact, the Statewide Human Trafficking Task Force, after they received our report, then convened a legislative committee to work on this bill, and there were at least two members of the Office of Justice Programs in the Department of Public Safety who were there working on this bill with us, very actively involved in the process. We also involved prosecutors, law enforcement, and service providers themselves. And so we did have a very much a collaborative process with that department.
Madam Chair,
Representative Anderson.
Was there any feedback from these individuals that were at this hearing or this gathering of law enforcement and other to give you feedback as to where and how this can be handled and done on a state level?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, what we envisioned was that it would be modeled much like the Battered Women's Programs, which is a process by which organizations that have expertise in dealing with, in that case, domestic violence victims, but in this case, sex trafficking victims, would apply to, there would be a grant process. It would follow, it could be very similar to the Battered Women's Programs, where a request for proposals can be put out by the Department of Public Safety, and then organizations can respond to that. Then they report back, of course, after receiving funding, back to the Department of Public Safety about what they're doing. We have had a fiscal note put together, and some members of the Department of Public Safety looked at this and looked at what it would cost and what it would take to do the administration. They've stated that it would be about a 2.5% fee or a 2.5% administrative cost in terms of administering the grant.
Madam Chair,
Representative
to the testifier, did the Commissioner of Public Safety testify at this hearing to say how much of this they can do or can't do and what they need to be able to make it work?
Ms. Allison.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, the Commissioner did not testify.
Madam Chair, I'd like to hear from the department if that's possible.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative, I had a private conversation with Commissioner Campion, and he was in general supportive of the omnibus trafficking bill. I don't think he had a chance to really examine the specifics, but his response to our initiative to address the comprehensive needs to really address sex trafficking in an effective way, he was very supportive of it. That was a private conversation that I had with him.
Representative Cole.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Clark, and the witnesses, and I don't think anybody sitting around the table thinks this is a bad idea, but it's kind of a bad time to be coming asking for more money. I don't want this to sound too flip, but, you know, we don't have the money right now. If we fund this, should we take money from, where should the money come from? We don't have the money. So how do we address this? I don't think anybody thinks it's a bad idea, but you know, Chairman Tamar has a negative $66 million target.
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, we do know that there is money being made available to the Office of Office on Violence Against Women, the Federal Office on Violence Against Women, as well as through the Byrne grants, and we have looked at and talked some with members of the Office on Justice Programs about possibly applying for some grants to for federal monies to offset some of the costs so that the cost for the state wouldn't be as great, and trying to leverage as much of those federal funds as we can. We're watching for the RFPs so that we can apply for those federal funds.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, or the witnesses, how many grantees do we anticipate? Do we have any sense for what the size of these grants would be? The bill doesn't spell that out.
Representative Clark. I think the fiscal amount is about $250,000.
Madam Chair, Representative, there are currently two nonprofit organizations in the metro area that are effectively providing housing and support services for sex trafficking victims. Those are two existing programs that could use some additional resources to increase their outreach, and I would anticipate that those two programs would apply for these funds and be excellent candidates for it. But if you don't mind, I just wanted to address, we know there's a very severe budget crisis here, but as a citizen of the state, I've been told repeatedly by my elected officials, you have to tell us what you need, and then we'll have to figure out how we can do what we can do. And so really, our intent is to say this is a need. These women are being raped. We found the body of one of our clients in an alley in northeast Minneapolis. This is a need, and so we bring it to you for your consideration.
Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, and I know you appreciate the situation we're in. I just hope that, you know, it can't go without being said that we have serious problems, and while I appreciate what you're trying to do, I just don't know how we do it when we're in the budget situation we're in. I appreciate you coming forward with your wants, your needs, your desires, whatever we want to call them, but I just don't know how we can put a new program on the books when we're going to be cutting funding for existing programs. That's where I'm coming from. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions.
Madam Chair.
Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just ask maybe the testifiers. I know we had, and I'm trying to learn more about the the sex trafficking problem we have. You mentioned 731 victims over 3 years. At what point do people become victims? Is it after adjudication of the alleged perpetrator, or is it at the time of allegation?
Madam Chair, Representative, the sex trafficking victim is defined in our statutes in 609.321, and sex trafficking itself is also defined as receiving, recruiting, enticing, harboring, providing, or obtaining by any means an individual for the purposes of prostitution. And a sex trafficking victim is one who has been subjected to that type of activity. And so by using that definition in the statute, we can say who a victim is. Now, as soon as the person comes forward and identifies themselves to law enforcement, then law enforcement can look at and see if that person fits the definition of sex trafficking victim. Typically, they would be going forward with a case against the trafficker themselves and be wanting to then interact with the victim, much like they do in cases of domestic violence, where they're talking to the victim, getting the testimony of the victim, so that they can then go forward with their prosecution of the perpetrator of the trafficking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Ms. Ellison, what I understand you saying is that at the time of allegation or the time someone comes forward and suggests that they have been a victim, that merely doing that constitutes them to be a member of a group of people then that these organizations potentially would work with and spend the grant monies on. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The other question I have is dealing with citizenship. Now, I understand that many of these people are people who may have been brought here against their will from other countries. Is the citizenship of these people checked before we expend these monies on them, or is it anybody that these programs would apply to?
Madam Chair, Representative, first of all, trafficking victims may be foreign nationals, but that's not necessarily the case. In fact, there are many Minnesota natives, U.S. citizens, legal permanent residents who are victims of trafficking. There's been a story that has been in the media for some time that they portray trafficking as being mostly foreign nationals, but that isn't the case. That isn't the case in Minnesota. There's trafficking that goes on from reservations to cities. There's trafficking that goes on within cities of various people, whether they might be Minnesota born, they might be here living, but even be either citizens or legal permanent residents. So the issue of their nationality is not isn't one that would be considered in terms of the population of trafficking victims is broad, is what I'm trying to say. And it includes all different U.S. citizens, legal permanent residents, and some foreign nationals as well.
Well, one more question. One more question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I may probably should have deduced from my first question that the answer is no, the citizenship status or resident status is in check, but thank you for clarifying that. Page 3, subdivision 5, under that particular section of the bill, 3.23 talks about the classification of the data and it being protected data or private data. Can you suggest, I guess I can understand maybe some of the reasons for making it private. I guess one of the problems I see is we've got public expenditures of money and no one will really know exactly where that money's going for. I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Madam Chair and Representative,
The private data pertains to, this is done much in the same way as it is with domestic violence victims, where it is, the organizations that are serving the victims would collect the information, they would aggregate it, and that information could be provided to the State Department of Public Safety, but individual data about one particular person would not necessarily be provided. That is to protect the safety of the victim, because in the cases of human trafficking, in the cases of other types of violence against women, the safety of the victim is something that is paramount in terms of continuing to protect that individual, also ensuring that they feel safe enough as needed to go forward with the prosecution of the perpetrator of the violence against them. And it is remodeled, again, as I mentioned earlier, remodeled this section after the battered women's programs. And it's consistent with how data is collected for that particular purpose.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Clark, to the testifiers, my understanding is what Representative Duskowski said, there was something of 700 and some odd number of people that were classified as victims last year. But in your bill, thank you, Madam Chair. In your bill, it says victims of human trafficking and any dependents accompanying the victims, or parents, or guardians, or minor victims. And then you go on further on and says trafficked persons and their children, or to trafficked youth. You're expanding victims to include families. Could be 10, 15 people in a family. Am I to understand that?
Representative Clark. Well, these are family issues. When you get a trafficked person, happens to be a mother, and she's got dependent kids, they all need to be housed and protected, and it's, the kind of retaliation that occurs is not going to be just against the mother in that case. So, yes, this is the kind of thing that would require attention to a family.
Madam Chair, Representative, one of the findings that we are uncovering in our work with 13 to 17-year-old girls in the American Indian community who have been trafficked into prostitution is that oftentimes it is a family member who is pimping them out. And these are 13-year-old girls. So we also know that a lot of the younger children in the family are being exposed to this activity. So it's very important that we do family interventions whenever possible, get those children out of that situation. And if that's appropriate, we want to make sure they get into kinship care or appropriate foster care living situation.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Clark, this is a huge undertaking.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Clark and the testifiers, I was reading here in Subdivision 1 on page 2, in the upper portion of the page, and it talks about, services provided, employment, education, language, and training opportunities. Is there any timeline as far as how long the victims of this trafficking would be eligible for these services?
I think we're going to be, again, modeling it on the successful programs that are already operating with victims of prostitution, and there are several folks here if you would like to hear from them about how long an individual may be using their program. I would suggest, I think it's usually a couple of years. People usually need to have the opportunity to get away from their perpetrator and to actually get, some opportunities, maybe they need some education. Maybe I'll let our
Madam Chair, Representative, often depends on how early we can intervene. If we can intervene with the younger girls, we have an excellent chance of getting them back on a good track in a relatively short amount of time. But for a 35-year-old woman who's been pimped out since the age of 9, it's going to be very difficult and it will take time. But in response to the comment, this is a huge undertaking. But this is an existing problem that is costing the taxpayers millions of dollars. We don't have an accurate number. But if we start to look at, if we just take one case study and look at one 15-year-old girl who is vulnerable, who's a runaway, who's a throwaway, who's aging out of a foster care situation, and there's no intervention for her, the likelihood of repeated law enforcement interventions, repeated judicial system interventions, detox, emergency room use, the damage to her, she's going to have children. Those children will be taken to the foster care system. That costs about $50,000 a year per child. Those kids have very poor outcomes. If we intervene early with her, we'll spend much less money. We have a better chance of making sure that that girl finishes school, has a healthy lifestyle. She may still have children, but she has those children at home with her. She's a taxpayer and maybe a homeowner. She's stably housed. So we do have a big problem on our hands, and I understand this is a bit overwhelming, but we're seeing the effects of a problem that has long been ignored by our system every single day in our communities, and these are children.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, do you know where this is modeled after and where else it's being done and not what state or what other city?
Madam Chair, Representative, this type of services are being provided in other states. We are a leader, though, in addressing this issue. In fact, recently when the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act was reauthorized in the end of 2008, that the federal government recommended that states come up with plans like this to provide for services for trafficking victims. And the federal government really said, we leave it to the states to come up with plans for how to come up with these services. Minnesota has long been a leader dealing with violence against women, and so we would be at the forefront if we were to take the step of providing and protecting for trafficking victims.
Just to let you know that people across the world are actually looking at what Minnesota is doing. Some Chinese nationals were just here this past week. They were guests of the state, and they came to talk to us about what Minnesota is doing on trafficking, and they are attempting to look at our model.
Well, Madam Chair, that's great. I appreciate that. I would like to hear, though, from the Commissioner of Public Safety, and I think it's wrong that they're not here.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Is this going to Chair PMR's committee?
The next stop is housing. So.
Will it eventually get to Chair PMR's
committee? I don't know. Representative Kramer, would this eventually need to go? Yes, it would eventually need to go to
PMR. I'll hold my question.
All right. Seeing no further questions, I renew my motion that House File 1636 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended referral to the Housing Finance Policy and Public Health Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Canadian, do you want to be next? The Chair moves House File 1518 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the General Register. Welcome to the committee, Representative Champion.
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee. This is House File number, as she so eloquently indicated, 1518, and this is an agency bill. It's very simple from our vantage point, but of course we will stand for questions. The agency currently is to provide statistical information around trafficking every year or annually. There's a desire to provide much more substantive information, and the department would like to change that from annually to every 3 years, and so that's pretty much the nature of the legislation or the bill.
Questions from members? Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, I think probably for the witness, who I assume is from DPS, legislators need information about this, I trust that you'll respond to our request for information between the three-year reporting period. Is that a fair assumption on my part?
State your name for the record.
I'm Jeanette Biskovic from the Office of Justice Programs in the Department of Public Safety. I am staff to the statewide legislatively mandated task force, and I write this report every year. And yes, we would provide any information that would be needed.
Madam Chair, Representative Champion, thanks for helping the department do its job a little better in these tough budget cuts.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
thank you so much for your vote of confidence.
Madam Chair,
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this provide any savings to the taxpayer by doing this?
Representative Champion.
I would allow the testifier to speak to that question.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do get this funding for the report mostly from our federal grant for the Statistical Analysis Center grant, but there is my in-kind time that I do every year on doing this project.
There weren't a representative.
So no, there is no savings.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 1518 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion for all. Representative Tamar. Representative Tamar moves that House File 1505 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Committee. Representative Tamar, it's my understanding that you are the A4 amendment.
I do, Madam Chair, and I would like to do that.
Representative Tamar moves the A4 amendment to get the bill in the form that he would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Tamar.
Madam Chair, I don't know how much of the bill you want me to go through. We covered it in Representative Chair Lesh's committee. The
as little as possible, Representative Tamar.
Then maybe I'll just cover the amendment then.
That would be great, Representative Tamar.
Basically, if you remember, for those members who were on that committee, we had a few mistakes on the amendment, so we didn't offer it at the time, and we fixed that. And all the A4 what the A4 amendment does is it under the 609.321, under the definitions of prostitution, we now have a definition of prior qualified human trafficking related offenses under the under 609.322 on solicitation, inducement, and promotion of prostitution. We've added the language sex trafficking and defined that both in sex trafficking in the first degree as well as the second degree, and you can see the language there. The third thing that the amendment does is that on page 3, it talks about aggregation of cases, and I would like my witness from the Advocates for Human Rights to talk about this, how this helps prosecutors charge crimes of sexual trafficking and how this can assist them, and that's the amendment. So, as well as Mary Ellison. Yeah.
Ms. Ellison, welcome to the committee. Please be brief in your comments, then go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. These amendments, the main change from the original bill, as Representative Tamar stated, was really making a first degree and a second degree crime. What we did from the time of the initial introduction of the bill and these amendments is that we spoke at length with several prosecutors who work on these type of cases. Those prosecutors are also part of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, and they said, if you want to give us tools that are stronger for us to charge cases of human trafficking, we need to have the aggravating factors, we need to have these structured as first and second degree crimes, much as some other felony crimes, such as assault, such as criminal sexual conduct, are structured this way with first and second degree. When we put the aggravating factors in, basically that the prosecutors told us that gives us the ability to look at cases, and if they are cases of human trafficking and if there are serious elements such as holding a trafficking victim for a long period of time, having multiple victims of sex trafficking, and having any bodily injury that is done to a trafficking victim, then we can use this statute to really go after the trafficker and try to get the maximum penalty. Because what the prosecutors were finding is that it was very difficult for them to charge sex trafficking and get any kind of serious penalty. Most of the time they were charging other types of felonies that didn't fit the crime as well as this particular statute does. and by not charging sex trafficking crimes, then they weren't able to get the greatest amount of penalty for the perpetrator.
Thank you. Questions from members?
Representative Colfer. Madam Chair, Representative Kamar, I'm tempted to add a little bit of levity to this very serious topic and say I think there might be hope for you yet. We've got a bill that has aggravated penalties, and Kamar, I'm welcome aboard. Representative Kamar, I think this is a good bill. I want to support it. I guess my question, though, goes to do we have any sense for what this is going to cost? I mean, I support it. I want to see it happen. I'm a supporter. I've been a supporter of some of the aggravated sentencing and enhanced penalties you've done in the past, but you've done a good job pounding into my head over the last couple of years when it comes to the price tag. And so I'm curious how we're gonna be able to do this good piece of legislation.
Representative Kamar.
Madam Chair, that's a good question, Representative Coles, and that's why the bill is going to the Public Safety Finance Committee. The fiscal note in the Senate was dramatically different than the fiscal note in the House. The fiscal note in the House, there would not actually be a bed impact, and it would be very minor until 2014. I have had sort of a policy, I didn't really want to get into this in your committee, Madam Chair, but I have had sort of a policy in our committee that we would not hear bills or probably not include them in the omnibus bill if there was going to be a bed impact to the Department of Corrections, or, as you know, we don't have the money, but I will leave it up to the committee to decide if something that's two bienniums out would be satisfactory. So that's my plan when it comes to the Public Safety Finance Committee. In the Senate, I think the fiscal note said till 2020 would there be a bed impact, so it's relatively slight.
I'm really glad to hear you say that, Representative Kamar, because I think I have a bill that has like a bed impact of one. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kamar.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kamar, to your testifier, how many people are on an annual basis prosecuted and charged, and what's their fine for prostitution? And are there people in prison or jail right now for that, along with the trafficking that we're coming up with, this new sex trafficking?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, right now there are some cases that are prosecuted under this same statute, 609.322, as promotion of prostitution statutes or charges, and we do have cases of that. I'm sorry I don't have the number right in front of me. I can provide that at a later time. One of the things we don't have with the way the statute is now is the ability to drill down and see how many charges it is now is the ability to drill down and see how many charges of sex trafficking we have. We do have broader figures on promotion of prostitution, which I can get to you later. I'm not sure if I answered your entire question. Was there another component?
Well, Madam Chair, well, I was just wondering if we're doing sex trafficking, we're inducement and promotion of prostitution. I'm just wondering, is there something that we don't? I mean, if we're doing it already, how many are we projecting that we're going to have more of getting into the prison system, and will this actually do the job that you're asking? I mean, if we're doing some of it now, that's why I want to know how many we're in prison, how many we've been actually charged, and how many are actually prison or jail, and what's the background history of it, and how many more can we go after, and how much of an impact is this going to have?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you. I was just provided the statistics from the Office of Justice Program Human Trafficking Report, and their report documented 1,811 trafficking-related charges in Minnesota between 2006 and 2007. That's everything from promotion of prostitution to solicitation of a child, solicitation of a prostitute. It includes all of those cases wrapped up together. What we believe this statute adds is a couple of things. First off, it'll allow us to track how many sex trafficking cases we have. It also, by putting in the aggravating factors into 609322, that sub paragraph B, it allows the prosecutors, when we worked on that part of the statute, said, give us a way so that if someone has done promotion of prostitution in the past, or they're doing it now and they have these aggravating factors involved, gives us a way that we can give them a higher penalty. In a case like that, the penalty, the maximum would be 25 years. So what it gets us is a little bit more of a bigger stick, I guess you could say, over the trafficker's head, and it gives the prosecutors really a strong penalty, so that some of the promotion of prostitution cases that we've had here in Minnesota, one example, the sentence that the individual received for promoting the prostitution of a child was approximately 7 years. If you ask me, that's not strong enough. If the maximum of the statute says for the promotion of prostitution of an individual under 18 is a maximum of 20 years, and that person got seven, trafficker got seven for that, that isn't strong enough. One of the reasons was because they didn't have as strong of a statute to use to prosecute that case.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, 1,811, that's what you come up with. How many of those are actually in jail or in prison?
Those were the, Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, those were the charges. Those that were convicted were 700, there were 729 that were actually convicted. I don't know that I have the cases or the statistics for the number that are in jail from those convictions. What I can say is that what we found out in doing our research is that typically traffickers, and more so even with patrons, spend very little time in prison or jail.
And Madam Chair, to the testifier, how many more do you expect with this amendment to this bill do you expect to get a hold of? I mean, just like we went after methamphetamine drugs, mm-hmm. We in Wright County, where I live, we've already found a great diminishing effect on it because law enforcement took an active role and the community took an active role. Is this going to do the same thing with this situation here by putting this in, and will law enforcement be able to get at these trafficking and go after more and get more people in prison? We're losing. We don't even have half of the people that we brought charges up on yet in prison.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, that is certainly what we hope, that law enforcement and prosecutors will be able to go after the traffickers and get them convicted and put them behind bars. One of the things that goes along with any time you change a criminal law is making sure that law enforcement, prosecutors, and all of those involved in the criminal justice system have the training that they need so that they learn how to recognize cases of human trafficking. These kinds of cases are very difficult to recognize. We've talked to 175 people as we were doing the sex trafficking needs assessment report, and many of those individuals, law enforcement and prosecutors included, said, we want you to help us to learn how to recognize trafficking victims. They were very open to it. We've met with the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We've met with other law enforcement who said, we want to prosecute these cases. We want to charge them. We want to go after these. But we also need the training. We need some tools to screen and recognize which cases are trafficking cases. They're hard to recognize.
Madam Chair, will this, are we modeling this after some other legislation someplace else in the nation? Are we leaders again?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, we have looked at a lot of different models. There's a lot of different models out there for trafficking legislation. There's a model that the Department of Justice put out, the Federal Department of Justice. There's a model that is done by a group called the Polaris Project that is based in Colorado. And There is a new recommendation when the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was reauthorized in 2008. They recommended that states create human trafficking laws that do not have an element that's in the federal law, which is an element of force, fraud, and coercion. The federal group that was responsible for the Trafficking Victims Protection Act said to the states that they should create laws so that they can make sure that there's a broad continuum of protection for trafficking victims. On the high end, those cases that involve force, fraud, and coercion are pursued typically. Those would be pursued by the federal law enforcement and federal prosecutors. And then there are a whole range of other cases that normally would fall through the cracks of the federal response that states need to take up. The federal government said, states, we want you to create laws that don't have the element of force, fraud, and coercion, much like our Minnesota law. So in terms of where we're at, we're right in line with what's being recommended by all of the different groups that are out there creating this type of legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the testifier may have just answered my question, but in talking about trafficking and the organized efforts, whether it be multi-state or within the city, if there's an organization that exists where if you take one, you know, trafficker off the street, does the organization still exist? And if there is such an organization, do the RICO statutes come into play where they can, you know, prosecute the larger, you know, trafficking organization rather than just individuals?
Madam Chair, Representative Szymanski, that is a good question. The RICO statutes are slightly different, and those, again, would be not necessarily used in these types of cases. My understanding from talking with prosecutors is that the law as we have it, the sex trafficking law, they would use because it's much more specific to the sexual exploitation, whereas RICO is much more about racketeering and money. Oftentimes gambling is involved with that. So it's slightly different. I can see where you're going with that question, but it's slightly different.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Paymont, I think your testifier is a good politician.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Paymar, the amendment, the newly amended language, which should be included in the amendment, lines 1.2 and then 1.2, 1.3, and then 1.6, 1.7. I'm just wondering about the language there. Receiving profit or anything of value, knowing or having reason to know, and maybe somebody with more legal background than me can help with this question, but it seems to me that the language or having reason to know leaves a lot of room open for interpretation and, you know, potentially abuse of the statute. I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Representative Bingham seems to think she has the answer.
I do.
Mr. Nebel, do you want to answer that?
Representative Driscoll and Representative Paymar, first, I like the bill. Unlike some people, I think it's good to be leaders instead of being mediocre. But the thing to know or have reason to know, if you knew that money came from a result of trafficking, you're in trouble. That's what this is going to say. Or if you knew, or you knew that Lex gave you the money and it was a result of trafficking, that's what this comment is saying. Same thing with theft and receiving stolen property.
May I add a caveat? Sure.
You know, maybe we should let Ms. Pirius do it instead of us debating it as members, but
I'm
Representative Lawrence.
Okay, I'm just stating the fact. And Representative Bingham, you're correct, but that's not so much the issue. The issue is proving it and having been in the position of having to prove to the jury,
yes,
beyond a reasonable doubt,
and it is that
joke. you knew. Is nigh on impossible to do, which is why cases like fraud almost never get prosecuted by county attorneys, even when it's kind of apparent, because
the standard's just too high to actually show that you knew something. It's almost as if you're trying to prove a negative.
Ma'am. Did you have anything to add to that, or did they
Madam Chair, maybe I'll just add that they are repeating language that's already in the prostitution statute. It's under 609.322 already.
Okay. All right. Seeing no further questions, Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 1605 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion approved. Thank you, Representative West. You have two bills, Representative West. Would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair.
Representative West moves that House File 1768 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. Representative West, do you move the A5 amendment to get the bill in the state that you would like it?
Yes, I would like to move that, Madam Chair.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, why don't I start with discussing House File 1461, which is the training provision of the Omnibus Bill 1768. House File 1768 includes the articles from Representative Clark, Clark's Bill 1636, Representative Paymar's Bill 1505, both of which you just heard, and then House File 1461, my bill, which is the Training and Public Awareness Initiative on Human Trafficking. The only other provision in the omnibus bill that is not included in those individual standalone bills is Article 4, which is the expansion of the MFIP eligibility. But with that, there are probably more concerns. I just ask myself to describe the amendment, although the amendment is just the same amendment we passed for Representative Paymar's bill members, because his bill is the Article 1 portion of my omnibus bill, so we're just keeping them the same.
Ms. Ellison, keep in mind that we've already had a number of these bills already, so if there's anything that you need to add that is different or additional.
Nothing additional, Madam Chair.
Members, do you have any questions because of what we've already done?
Oh, Madam Chair, I do.
Representative Cole.
Representative Lesh, can you talk to Article 4 and tell me what we're doing there?
We didn't do that one, I don't think.
Representative Lesh.
Madam Chair, Representative Cole, no, but I'll have
Ms. Ellison.
Madam Chair, Representative Coles, and members, Article 4 has to do with eligibility for the Minnesota Family Investment Program. You may be aware that in the MFIP program, we have currently something that is called the Family Violence Waiver. What we're doing is creating a similar type of waiver for victims of human trafficking. We're doing this because for those victims of human trafficking that have children, as has been stated earlier by the previous testifiers, oftentimes those individuals need time to stabilize their families, stabilize themselves, so that they can then become productive citizens. And so the MFIP, they would be eligible to apply for the human trafficking waiver. They would have to provide evidence that they were a victim of human trafficking, and then they would, if they qualified for the MFIP, they would be able to have that. They would come up with their employment plans much in the same way as domestic violence victims do. They would be eligible for an extension if needed, if they were in a position where they were still suffering from the consequences of the human trafficking, where they could go beyond the usual 60-month limit on MFIP.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cole.
What's the motion in this bill?
It's going to Representative Paymar's committee.
Representative Lesh, has this Article 4 been heard in the Health and Human Services Committee? Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, I realize that those of us on this side of the aisle are in the deep minority in the House here, but I'm not so sure we should be having an omnibus bill. There's some good things that we're doing. I'd hate to see some of the good things go down with, as a result of some of the other things that just may not be possible this year, given the budget situation and other things. So take that advice for what you paid for it, Representative Lesh, but I'm not sure I'd hate to see some of these things that we've been talking about tonight not happen because others obviously just can't happen for budget reasons or whatever.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of course, I think that probably is one of the reasons why we're moving them separately and as well, and we're going to pick and choose between what we are able to do at the end of the game here. I will take the advice of one of you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would have a similar question for this, Ms. Ellison. The victim definition is similar to the other bill that, there doesn't have to be adjudication before they're determined to be a victim for this article.
Madam Chair, Representative Drazkowski, they would provide evidence, credible evidence, and that could come in the form of somebody, a service provider who is working with the human trafficking victim, could provide evidence that they have told their story and that they fit the definition of human trafficking, sex trafficking victim. In terms of an adjudication, a formal adjudication, no, but there would be evidence that would need to be presented and would have to be deemed to be credible.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Elton, the follow-up to that, the citizenship status or resident status? Same question, I guess, to this one. Similar answer?
Madam Chair, Representative. Currently, as it stands in this statute, there already is a definition. If you look to page, we have the federal law is included here, and that. Sorry. Okay. It's on page 10 and lines 1023 to 1026, and that refers to the Federal Trafficking Victims Protection Act. That was already in the statute, and under that, if an individual is a trafficking victim and also a foreign national, there is a process that individual would go through to be determined to be a human trafficking victim. That person would typically be involved in pursuing relief under our Immigration and Nationality Act in the form of either a T visa or a U visa. At the same time, they would be applying for benefits.
Seeing no further questions, Representative West renews his motion that House File 1768 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. All those in, as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passed. Representative West, your bill. House File 1461. Representative West moves that House File 1461 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would again refer to Ellison on this, describing the training and public awareness initiative.
And Ms. Ellison, this was in the bill we just passed, correct?
Yes, it was, Madam Chair.
Okay, so please be brief.
I think I've said all the points I want to say on this, unless there's questions, Madam Chair.
Questions from members. Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Lesh renews his motion that House File 1461 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance with the recommended re-referral to the Public Safety Finance Division. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Bingham, the final bill for the evening. Representative Bingham would like to move that House File 1764 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Public Safety Omnibus Bill. Representative Bingham, it's my understanding that you found an error in the bill and you'd like to move an oral amendment. No, you wouldn't.
No, I would not, Madam
Chair. Okay, great. Glad to hear it. Representative Bingham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 1776.
1764.
That's what I meant.
1764.
That one, too. Deals with...
the Board of Pharmacy. Every year, the Board of Pharmacy is supposed to, through rulemaking, codify the new schedule that the federal government implements for pharmaceutical drugs. And it's not happening. And also, what this bill does is ask, much like a revisor, a technical revisor bill, every year, we're asking for the statutes to be updated every year. One, it helps due process, and also the prosecuting attorneys are having some issues being able to keep up to date with the new scheduled drugs. So this is what the bill does. I do have Cody Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy to answer any questions that one may have on the bill. And well, if Representative Paymar was here, I would say that there is no fiscal note on this bill. Questions from members? Representative Cole.
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, you said that this isn't being done now. It's supposed to be done. It's not being done now. The state of Minnesota, worst place to date is we don't get this report every year. I probably have a big problem with your bill, but are we just creating more work for the board?
Representative Fang. Madam Chair, Representative Coles, it's being and I can let you answer to this. It's not being done in statute, so therefore it's difficult for the prosecutors to be able to find the new drugs. It's sometimes being done through rulemaking, but if it's done during statute, they would be able to know to give due process to people, but also to know and keep up to date on the drugs that are being scheduled from the federal government. It is really a technical bill.
Thank you.
I can speak to that a little bit. Again, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. First of all, this isn't a Board of Pharmacy bill. Representative Bingham came to us. We have no objections to it. There's a minimal amount of extra work to be done. And what I can confirm is that I've talked to a variety of county attorneys from around the state, at least three or four, I should say. About half of them don't have a problem with the fact that controlled substances, that the Board of Pharmacy has the authority to change the schedule for controlled substances by rule. And that, in fact, if you were to compare the controlled substance list that's in statute with rules, you'd find that the one that's in rules is far more updated than the one in statute. And about half of the attorneys I talked to don't have a problem with that. They say they can prosecute. The other half say that they really can't prosecute if it's only in rules, and they really want to see the legislature take what the board has done and put it from rules into statute, and it would make it easier for them to prosecute cases.
Questions from Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Will the report that would be filed under this bill help in any way for law enforcement or the medical profession to identify abuse or fraud in prescription drug dispensaries?
Representative Cole. No, thank you. One thing, and then I'll let Dr. Weinberg say. Representative Kaminsky, one of the big and upcoming trends, and it's already kind of starting, is the prescription drug abuse and some of the prescription drug fraud that is happening. My answer is yes, because prosecutors would be more, it'd be more accessible for prosecutors to be able to see which drugs have been scheduled. Sometimes they see them and they don't, they're new drugs, they don't know what they are, and it's just very confusing for them. So I would argue yes, and I can let my testifier answer.
Chair, Representative. Representative Bigham would be correct in terms of the prosecution. You might also just want to be aware, it's more for information, that the Board of Pharmacy, because of an act the legislature passed 2 sessions ago, is in the process of developing what's called a controlled substance prescription electronic reporting system, because as Representative Bigham pointed out, prescription drug abuse is on the increase. And when that system is in place, which it should be in place by January of next year, every controlled substance prescription that's dispensed in the state will be reported to the Board of Pharmacy, and physicians and pharmacies around the state will be able to access that system electronically through a secure link, and they will be able to look for people who, for example, might be going to multiple doctors to get multiple prescriptions written. There's also been a bill just recently introduced in both the House and the Senate. I don't have the bill number with me. That would, if it's passed, would require the Board of Pharmacy to distribute tamper-proof prescription pads to prescribers around the state.
Thank you. I believe that's the answer I was looking for.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bigham, in light of your witness's testimony, wouldn't we be better off to get rid of the schedule that's in statute and refer everybody to the rules? And I mean, it's a whole lot easier for, it's a challenge for the board to promulgate rules, but we're only around here hopefully for you know, 5 months every other year and 3.5 months the other year. Why wouldn't we want to get the schedule out of the statute books and simply refer to the rules directly and then send the prosecutors to the rules? If the prosecutors can't go online and search Minnesota rules and find the schedule, we've got problems, much bigger problems in our county attorney's offices than what this bill is doing.
Representative Bingham.
Thank you. And I can represent Diebel. If Mr. Diebel wants to, it's getting late. Mr. Diebel wants to talk to that, but I have a feeling it has to do maybe with some due process things, but I don't know.
Mr. Diebel.
Madam Chair and members, I have looked at this issue, and there's a case that says that if the substance is listed in the rules, that's sufficient notice to citizens that the drug is controlled and that criminal penalties apply. But as the testifier noted, there are prosecutors that are unwilling to rely on the rules for charging decisions, and if it's not in the statute, they won't charge the offense.
Representative Bingham and Representative Coles, we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion, and so maybe the two of you can get together and talk.
I can't wait, Madam Chair.
The chair lays over House File 764.
Thank you. Members, an announcement. Remember, reminder that the Public Safety Omnibus Bill will be released at 9:30 tomorrow morning. Amendments to the bill will be due to our office, even if the language isn't done. At least the idea of what it's going to be will be due to our office by tomorrow evening at 6 p.m. I do need to approve one set of minutes for Thursday, March 19th. Representative Bingham,
yeah.
Move the minutes of March 19th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And with that, members, meeting adjourned.